Call a meeting to order. Representative Mariani, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It's always such a pleasure to see you with your bills. And I'll move that House Bill 722 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Mariani, again, welcome to the committee. Go ahead. And we have two people for the bill, two people against the bill. We've got two people for and two people against. So if you can, try to keep witnesses to your testimony to about, you know, if you can, about 5 minutes each, okay?
Thank you,
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We vetted this bill last year, and we had a packed house, and we had a number of testifiers, so we had to really work to just get it down to two, but I appreciate the time. Members, the U.S. Supreme Court, a while back, I'm not quite remembering the years, but it's been a while, decided that all minors existing within our national borders are entitled to a K-12 education. I personally think it was a civilized thing to do and a smart thing to do and a just thing to do to make sure that all young children have access to education. Some years ago, the federal government, in a federal law, tucked away in a bigger law a preemption, I would argue an intrusion on the federal government in terms of the state's prerogative of determining residency status for its residents in terms of access to post-secondary, in terms of whether young people or people are entitled to in-state or out-of-state tuition rates. And what they did is basically said to states, even though they've never weighed in on this issue before, that if you have undocumented children, even though the U.S. Supreme Court says they're entitled to a K-12 public education, if you have undocumented children, they cannot have in-state tuition rate status, regardless of how long they've been here, regardless of the conditions, et cetera, unless you then also offer in-state tuition rates to everyone in the United States, which, of course, becomes a huge financial issue for all states. As a result, a number of states, beginning, I believe, with Texas, the first state, and frankly, it was President Bush's vice governor, lieutenant governor, who then became governor, who signed this law. So this is a bipartisan issue, members. Several states have since passed laws to clarify that undocumented students, if they meet certain requirements, would indeed be eligible for in-state tuition. There have been efforts, with both GOP and Democrat support, to pass a federal law to undo that intrusion of 10 years ago that I mentioned earlier. That has not been passed yet, but since then, several states have passed a clarification making it possible for undocumented students, which we are currently investing in our K-12 system, per U.S. Supreme Court law, that they have access to our institutions with in-state tuition rates. Now, members, none of these students are eligible for financial aid. That is not the issue here before you. You have to be a U.S. citizen in order to access financial aid. And so what we're talking about here is allowing these students a more affordable access to post-secondary, but nowhere near the kind of access that U.S. citizens have who have access to financial aid. You all know the cost of education. It will continue to be a burden, a huge burden, a huge heavy burden for these students, even if we pass this law, but at least it provides them with a better avenue than charging the out-of-state tuition rate. Members, again, we are investing in these students. They are sitting in the chairs next to our U.S. citizen students in our K-12 system. Many of them, frankly, have been brought over when they were very young. Obviously, they're all minors. They were brought over when they were very young. They didn't have a choice whether or not they would be residing in this country or not. We can get into the issues of why their parents made those decisions. That's not the scope of this bill. Those who are going to argue against this in part are going to tell you that you're going to be dictating immigration policy. I would say not. You know, what you're doing is you are affirming Minnesota education policy, which is if we're investing in a 10-year-old today in our public schools, then we also want to invest in that 20-year-old 10 years later in our post-secondary schools. You all know, you've heard the testimony about what's happening demographically in our state. Our state cannot be throwing away students who badly aspire to be well-educated, to be contributing members of our society. Our economy needs that. There are, so the bill frankly says, undocumented students in Minnesota shall have access to in-state tuition rate. It's not a special privilege, doesn't put them above anyone else. It gives them a fair shot of becoming an educated individual. It further prescribes that a student must be here three or more years, and attending a Minnesota high school. So you're not going to have students walking over and accessing in-state tuition. These are students we have invested in. They must graduate from Minnesota high school or be a recipient of a GED. They must be registered to be enrolled in a public higher institution of education in our state. And we're also asking these students to be able or to commit to affidavits that say they will pursue citizenship as part of their goals. Obviously, an educated citizenry, which is what we're all after here, is to their benefit. It is to our benefit as well. So there are some strong parameters drafted around this requirement. So, members, I'm going to stop there. I'm going to ask the testifiers to come up. We have a student who's going to share with you some thoughts. And then we have an economist who's also going to share some thoughts with you as well. I'm going to ask them to come forward, and I'll ask them to be quick and brief. So come on up.
Welcome to the committee, witnesses. Just give your name for the tape when you start speaking.
Chair Rufabina, committee. My name is Emmanuel Rojas. I'm a student from ISD 286, and I'm just here to share with everybody what I've been through and how or why I believe that, you know, the Dream Act should pass. I came here when I was three. I was a little kid, you know, like Sir here said, you know, I didn't really have a choice. And when I came here, I was just a little kid growing up, you know, and I had a little brother, little sister now, which now they're growing up too. And as they get older, you know, we've been taught by our parents that, you know, treat everybody with respect, you know, treat everybody equally, you know, just be a good person, demonstrate to everybody that you're good and at what you do. And now that I'm growing up, I've thought about going to college, and I'm sure that I'm going to college, which is not really far from me. I'm a 10th grader, so I have about two more years to go, and then I'm graduating. And what I want to do is, you know, pursue a career in criminal justice, you know, just give back to the community just like they giving back to me, how they protected me. And things I've been through, you know, they've always helped me out. So now that I'm getting older, I want to just give back, you know, show everybody that they've done things for me now. Well, now I could do things for them too. And, you know, I always just believe in helping out other people, especially after they do things for you. You do things for them. You can't always expect everybody to hand you things. You got to earn your things. My parents have taught me that since I was a young kid. And now that I've grown older, like I said, I just plan to show everybody that I got something for them. Just like they've given me the good things, I want to go to school, get my career. You know, maybe one day I'll even find people out there who are doing bad and just make this whole city, state, make it a better place. You know, it's a real nice place that I live here, and I've been here for some years now. And I just want to give back to it because it's given me so many good things. It's given me an education, and I've been here for a while now. So I just hope to get a chance, you know. And I believe that the Dream Act should pass just because a lot of kids like me have tried hard and are doing good in school. You know, and we just want a simple chance. We want to grow up in our environment, just get older and keep what we want to do. You know, people got to have a goal in life. And my goal in life is just to be a better person. So I want to just show everybody that I could be a good person, but everything that I need is just a simple chance. It's not like every year I could come up with $20,000, $30,000 for college. And that thing's coming up real quick for me. As I grow up, time gets faster and faster. I only have 2 more years to go. So when I get out, I don't plan to just work. I plan to do something for this place. Plan to give back to everybody who's giving back to me. And thank you.
Thank you very much, man. We'll hold our questions until... Welcome,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'm an economist. I also travel a lot, and very recently I was in Singapore.
You'll just say your name for the record.
Bruce Corey, professor at Concordia University, St. Paul. Just the other day, I was talking to my students this morning. I was in Singapore, and if you bring a Singapore student his age or some of the youth in this room and put them head-to-head on a global competition, science, math, education, we're going to have some troubles, and national studies have shown that. When we look at Minnesota, there are only 30% of our population that have high, some college degrees and higher, 30%. We want to compete in a global competitive economy with 30% of our population having college education. I want to implore on you, please take access out of the picture. If we are going to get bogged down on questions of access, 10 years from now, you'll be seeing a different story. We have to focus on quality, because with quality, there's improvement. With every year of education, their earnings go up by 11%. Big difference. Studies in California have shown an increase in public revenue of about $2,500. So we've got to focus, and that's my question, and I'm adding input from a student here, Joventina Mesa, who was also part of it. I've got data, I've got a formal presentation, I'll email it to the committee for the data that you might need, but I just want to focus on a simple point. Please take access out of the picture. Treat every Minnesotan as human capital that needs investment, because firms are asking for people with higher productivity, and our jobs of the future are demanding higher skills, and we need to invest in that quality of human capital, regardless of who owns it. As an economist, there's a concept called GDP. We measure the wealth of countries according to what is produced in the country. We don't question who owns it, because their wealth is produced here in this country. Let's treat our young people that way. Invest in them, because they are going to be the future of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions of either of the witnesses at all, or of Representative Mariani? Okay, and then with that, Representative Eastland?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to thanks for coming and for the testimony and the bill. I mean, I think it raises a important question, very important question. I mean, and I think everybody here has to understand the political difficulties that it also brings. So, I mean, it's a complex issue. But I just have a question. What happens now when an undocumented student applies at the University of Minnesota or at MinSCU? Is there a process where they're required to reveal that information, or does it just kind of happen and they can go now? So, I mean, what happens currently? Do we know?
Is there anybody that knows? Otherwise, we have someone, we have a few people from the Office of Higher Education, I see, and from the university. Ma'am, are you going to fill us in here since our lobbyists can't come on down?
Come on down?
Yes, come on down and tell us if you know the answer to that question. Just come down, identify yourself, and tell us if it's anecdotal or not. Since nobody else is coming to the mic, we'll find out what's going on.
I am Rose Vegas Shannon. I work for the Minneapolis Community Technical College. I am the academic advisor for the Latino population. At the college, our admissions will ask whether you have, whether you're a citizen, a resident, or a visa, or other. And most of our students who don't have their documents will mark off as other. So they're aware of that. they don't ask them for documentation at this point. They're aware of the fact that these students are undocumented.
Okay. Maybe council can shed some light too, Ms. Novak.
Mr. Chair and members, both the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota State Colleges and University, as the testifier said, ask the applicant to indicate whether they're a citizen or not.
Okay. Representative Eastland.
And then a follow-up. Does that affect the institution's willingness to accept them as a student? And then my question is that what triggers the out-of-state tuition formula to kick in, or what happens when that box is checked? There are institutions allowing undocumented students now to already go at in-state tuition. I guess I've heard anecdotally that there are schools that allow them to come at in-state tuition rates now. So, I mean, I guess how prevalent is that?
Ma'am, could you answer that question, since you have the experience at your facility, or Representative Mariani?
Once it has the other status in our application, it goes right into an out-of-state tuition, definitely. Okay. We recently had a change at MCTC where we were not charging out-of-state tuition. It changed in January, so we're all now across the board charging everybody out-of-state tuition.
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, members, and there's a couple issues here. One is the U of M, of course, is a semi-autonomous land-grant institution that does reserve for itself the right, at least I stand corrected by council, does reserve for itself the right to be able to determine the student status in regards to this issue. Our Minnesota system, however, is in a tougher position in this regard in terms of perhaps having their hands tied by this federal legislation. I can tell you, because I've interacted with a number of people in the Minnesota system, including many of the presidents, they're educators. They want to educate these young people. They often will interact with these young people through K-12 programs leading up to their eventual solicitation into the system. This is a soul-searching, heart-rendering decision on their part once these students do apply to their institutions. We need to clarify Minnesota intent so that we're not putting our state colleges, each one of our campuses, in that kind of vague position where someone may force a legal challenge. But I can tell you, I don't know if there's anyone here from MISCU, but I can tell you their desire is to do their work, which is to educate Minnesota's young people. And they're struggling with this issue on a campus-by-campus basis.
Okay, any other questions for the witnesses? Thank you very much, then. Thank you for your testimony, all of you. Mr. Dell Erickson. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Erickson. Just identify yourself. The page, is that Nina or Anders? Just identify yourself before you start talking, so we got your name on the tape. Welcome.
My name is Dale Erickson. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's an honor to be here this afternoon to be able to speak with you. The economists, if I can just remark just briefly on what the economists said. What he has said really applies to all Minnesota kids and all Minnesota students. Moreover, he distinguishes between the globalist and the sovereign nation or of the sovereignty of the state of Minnesota. He believes apparently that Minnesota is a place rather than a sovereign state, and I would disagree with that. This bill is an illegal alien tuition scheme. It is a program designed to encourage and assist illegal aliens to remain in the state of Minnesota. It is in violation of federal law. It harms vulnerable Americans, our children. The immigration industry characterizes the bill as a dream act. Indeed, it is one of the most wonderful dreams an illegal alien could dream of. Not surprisingly, reporters refer to it as a measure that supports education and streamlines education reform. Many also say most of the eligible children are children who only wish to better themselves and their communities. The irony is, that's exactly what Minnesota kids, Minnesota citizens say as well. For Americans, however, this bill is a nightmare. It is a nasty and costly illegal alien amnesty disguised as an educational initiative while granting residency and amnesty to an unlimited number of illegal aliens. The immigration industry claims the current immigration system is unfair and needs to be changed. Reflected by this bill, they call it reform and equity. This is, of course, self-serving nonsense. The reform goal is to eliminate U.S. borders and to remove all distinctions between citizens and non-citizens and apparently the American identity. H-1B visa, indeed the entire H-1H family of visa, replaces American employees with foreign workers. This nightmare act takes the process another step. It denies large numbers of Americans an education, and as a result, works to deny Americans jobs. In perverse irony, it's therefore, employers will say that there are no suitable American workers available, and thus want to increase the H-1B program. It is circular, continually denying education and increasing the elimination of Americans from jobs in their own country. How does it end? Badly, of course. As I will speak to later, it can only end when all the children in Mexico or wherever are in Minnesota in U.S. schools and employed. The bill harms Minnesota students and contravenes Minnesota and federal laws. It is illegal for illegal aliens to reside in Minnesota. It is discriminatory. Because the number of openings for admission to our school systems is limited, admission of illegal aliens displaces a similar-sized group of qualified Minnesota and U.S. citizens and legal permanent residents. Indeed, because the school admission programs are based on income, race, and other factors intended for less advantaged citizens, illegal aliens are likely to be admitted ahead of Minnesotans or U.S. citizens. These violations are by the nature ongoing. Potential lawsuits. Well, the good news is that citizens will be able to sue in state or federal court to block unlawful policies and to sue officials and employees in their official or private capacities for violation of their rights. This has been seen now in the workplace where employers who have hired illegal aliens are being sued by employees who have been discriminated against and successfully sued. It also has a aspect that it threatens Minnesota and national security. If you recall, the September 11th attacks were carried out by illegal aliens in Minnesota and the United States under the guise of being students. Remittances, as will be discussed later, are an open invitation to increase illegal activity. The legislation would allow illegal aliens to live in Minnesota legally, to obtain driver's licenses, attend college as in-state residents, work legally, likely including issuance of a Social Security number, and except for voting, all the benefits of citizenship. This bill shamelessly places the interest of illegal aliens above American families and lawful residents who have paid taxes and played by the rules. It implies that any foreigner contemplating higher education in the United States would be better off breaking our laws by coming here illegally than waiting until they reach college and applying to become as a foreign student. National and local polling clearly demonstrates that illegal aliens should be ineligible for in-state tuition rates at colleges and universities. Disapproval of these kinds of legislation is the reason legislatures never or rarely, only rarely discuss the issue at town hall meetings. These kinds of bills are very unpopular. In California, they've taken some effort to stop this. And what they've done is passed or considered trespassing laws where they consider illegal aliens as regarding trespassing. Similar legislation should be passed by the Minnesota legislation. There's one thing that's not mentioned, it should be, is that it promotes a chilling school environment and institutional bias. Picture two students sitting side by side in a classroom, as noted earlier, one an American, the other an illegal alien. The American knows the other student is a criminal alien and is usurping the educational resources intended for her. Yet, if she writes an essay from the American view, her mark will be low or failing. And if she speaks out, she knows she will be expelled from the school. The silver lining in this bill is that because the DHS, Department of Homeland Security, and ICE doesn't have a handle on the numbers or where they reside, the positive aspect of this bill is that all these illegal aliens must register and be on a list. The day is coming. Very soon, I believe, as the groundswell across the country demonstrates, where illegal aliens will be encouraged to leave our country to return to their homeland. It is called attrition through enforcement. Those on lists are likely to receive special invitations. How can it end? Well, some numbers. Answer, it won't, unless immigration laws are enforced and modified. You can read the part I have on immigration and remittances, and the part about the immigration industry is a baby industry, and then combine them with chain migration. What we have is as these students age, they can then be able to bring in their entire families from distant areas. And if you have illegal aliens, it makes them legal after a while and becomes endless. There's I must just mention one thing because it was specifically mentioned in the bill, is that the role of the military. The bill grants citizenship to illegal aliens who manage to serve in the U.S. Army and the Marines. I don't believe the other branches accept them. This literally makes illegal aliens indentured servants.
Sir, I don't think that bill does the same. Sorry for interrupting you.
I'm sorry?
This bill does not do what you just said, so you must be on another bill.
I'll get your, if it's okay, Mr. Chair, I'll get back to that in just a moment.
Okay, wrap it up.
Okay. Thank you. It makes these illegal aliens indentured servants, which has long been outlawed. It also makes them mercenaries. It should not be need stating, but historically nations that used non-citizens to do their fighting have died as a nation. I'll conclude by saying that everyone who proudly abides by the immigration laws of the United States, whether American-born or not, dream that America and United States, Minnesota and the United States, remain a nation of laws, and that illegal aliens should not be rewarded but deported. This bill must stop here. Illegal alien children and their illegal parents should return to their native countries, apply for visas, and get in the immigration queue like other prospective immigrants. A short quote from Tuesday's Star Tribune sums it all well. The owners of labor-intensive farms and factories didn't abandon their docile worker dream. They have been looking for clever ways to guarantee a semi-slave workforce. And I must add, as do their unions. One egregious effect of this legislation is that American students will find their education opportunities foreclosed upon and their jobs taken by illegal aliens. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Erickson? Okay, thank you. Mr. Bueller? And Mr. Bueller, I was a little generous in giving Mr. Erickson a considerable amount of time, so hopefully you stick to the 5 minutes I requested that the other side stick to.
Okay. Yes, my name is Norman Bueller, and I'm here not just on my own behalf, but as a spokesperson for the thousands of our members in the immigration reform groups that are scattered around the state of Minnesota. MUIR, M-U-I-R, Minnesotans United for Immigration Reform, here in the Twin Cities, and MNSIR,
Sir, could you sit down and speak on the
mic?
That way we can get it on record.
Yeah, we can hear you better. Welcome.
I'm here as a spokesperson for not just myself, but for thousands of our members organized in various immigration reform groups around the state of Minnesota. MUIR, M-U-I-R, Minnesotans United for Immigration Reform, and MINSIR, Minnesotans Seeking Immigration Reform, and others throughout the state. And we have affiliations with similar groups throughout all of the other 50 states, the other 49 states. This is a very serious, serious issue that we're facing with immigration, as you know. This particular act is, or bill rather, is just a part of a whole collection of bills that are very corrosive, that are very injurious to this country. And there's a lot of you cannot take this bill just as a standalone bill. It has widespread ramifications, and it carries like an iceberg. 1% of it is what you see, and that's what's in the language of the bill. The other 99% you really have to be aware of. There's an awful lot of baggage, a lot of costs that come along with this bill, things you don't see. A little bit like the iceberg that did the Titanic in. That nothing has any meaning without its context. So let me tell you a little bit about that context and what this bill and others like it how that fits in with that context. Let me tell you about the corruption that's going on in this country, the wink and a nod that we treat our immigration laws, and this is generating, I can tell you, on personal experience and on connections with other people, this is creating a lot of anger. And for that reason alone, you should not pass this bill. The proponents of it would like to have you think that, oh, it's just about staying competitive in the marketplace and educating young people. Well, look at it from the other side. These are people that should be back in their home countries contributing to their economies. And there's a reason why they're here. And that reason is corruption there. And it's starting to infect this country in such a way that I don't like it, and our members don't like it. We hate to see what's going on, but, you know, it seems like a good thing to do, to give in-state tuition subsidies, to make the access to our educational systems equal to everyone who lives here. Well, that's the same kind of sloppy, simplistic thinking that got us to a point where we thought all we had to do is just go in and remove a nasty dictator, and then we'll just put on a new, like putting on a new coat of wallpaper. We'll just run in there with a prepackaged democratic system, and everybody will live happily ever after. Well, there are unintended consequences. There are huge, huge costs to this kind of corrosive treatment of our legal system. And of the sentiments of the people whose country this is. Speaking of which, that's citizenship, isn't it? Or should we say citizenship's medicineship? What difference does it make? Really, what difference does it make? Why should anybody even fight or struggle for this country? It's just a piece of ground, open, free-range land. There's no country here. That's what this law says, or this bill says. Just disregard all of that. And all of the people that have struggled to fight for this country and have built this country into what I believe is, though I don't think it's guaranteed to last, the greatest country ever seen on this planet. And I really resent bills like this that will denigrate that. Citizenship in this country should mean something, and this bill just trashes that meaning. Let me give you an idea of one of the costs of the way in which we've one of the costs I'll hold up this picture. I don't know if you can see it very well. He paid a cost fighting for this country because to him citizenship meant something. His name is Chris Agle, and he was killed fighting, defending this country. Now, he wasn't killed in Somalia or the former Yugoslavia or Iraq or Afghanistan. No, he was killed right down in Arizona on our southern border. Now, I'm not saying that the young people that are here today who are pleading for this act to, or bill to pass have anything to do with that kind of violence. But what this bill does, along with the other of its kind, is that it encourages this northward flow across our southern border. And guess what? Along with these campesinos and trabajadores come the drug dealers. And Chris Agle thought that when he was encountering the innocent campesinos and trabajadores coming north, instead he ran into a group of really mean hombres, armed to the teeth, and they wasted him. Now, did he die for nothing? This bill says yes. On the other hand, looking at it from the southern side of the border, you should be familiar with this bill. I don't know if any of you recognize him, maybe can't see it very well. His name is Carlos Slim. 2 years ago, he's a son of a Lebanese immigrant into Mexico. 2 years ago, his net worth went up by $10 billion in 2005. Last year, it went up by $19 billion. He is now third on the recently announced Forbes list of world's billionaires, right after Warren Buffett and Bill Gates. Now, it would seem to me as if it'd be reasonable to expect somebody like him to pay some taxes in Mexico to help subsidize the education of their own children, not expect Minnesotans or United States citizens to do that. There's a lot of wealth in Mexico. It's a beautiful country, thousands of miles of world-class white sandy beaches, lots of natural resources, oil, and so on. But very, very little of it is getting down. They have problems, and it's due to corruption. You hear that all the time, that's the reason why they came north. These people went through a lot of trials and tribulations and expenses. They seemingly had the money to pay the coyotes to help smuggle them and their children into this country to violate our laws. Instead, they should be in Mexico petitioning their own government for these kinds of in-state tuition or in-estado tuition discounts. That's what ought to happen. But this bill is very, very insidious. It doesn't talk about that. It doesn't say anything about the context. But you have to, it's a package deal. You have to take the whole thing. All of these costs, including Chris Agle, and he's not the only one that has been killed by these armed drug smugglers that use the innocent ones as mules and as covers to gain entry into this country. So don't pass a bill like this that is so corrosive to our respect for law. That's a key reason as to why they're coming in this direction, not the other way. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bueller. Any questions of Mr. Bueller? Okay, Representative Mariani, do you want to wrap things up here?
Sure.
Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, it would be good to get back to my bill before you, so let me just do that. Members, don't be distracted, please. Don't be led by myths. Don't be race-baited on these issues. As someone whose own family are immigrants who have fought in U.S. wars going back to World War II, I can tell you that My purpose here is to put forth before you a way to legally permit and allow our education venture in our state to go forward with the young children that we are currently investing in our K-12 schools. Supreme Court law is very clear about this. These are our investments. We are currently investing in these children. I've been around the block a little bit. I've worked through several major immigration changes. I can tell you that these young children want to be citizens. They most likely will be citizens. We want them to be educated citizens. These are Minnesota kids. Their families do pay state taxes. Our higher ed institutions are supported through state taxes. The federal government did a massive intrusion into the prerogative of states to determine how to use their state taxes in support of our higher ed institutions and our ventures there. There is a groundswell. Several states have passed this legislation. It has withstood legal challenge repeatedly. Several other states are lining up, as we are, to also do the right thing for their residents. There is a movement in Congress, or has been, in a bipartisan manner, both at the state and at the federal level in Congress, to address this issue. But meanwhile, the clock is ticking on Manuel. The clock is ticking on lots of wonderful young children who have been here for many, many years. And they're only asking for one thing, which is they're not asking for special privilege. They're asking for an ability to continue with their education so that they can give back. You heard from the young man. They can give back to the communities that they are very much a part of. And so, members, I know it's a difficult issue. I appreciate folks struggling with this. We should be struggling with good public policy. But this is really the right thing to do. We're not setting precedent here. There are other states that have moved out before us, and as I said earlier, have withstood legal challenges in this regard. We do reserve for all states reserve for themselves the right to determine status in terms of in-state and out-of-state tuition rates. So, members, I appreciate, Mr. Chair, you entertaining this discussion today, and I hope later on when you're putting together your bill that you'll be able to act benevolently and goodly on this proposal. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative, any questions? Representative Norton.
Chair Rukavina and Representative Mariani, I do think this is the right thing to do, and I happen to be quite serious about dealing with the immigration issues that we have in this state. I just don't feel that this is part of it, and I would beg to disagree with the gentleman that testified before that this is just one of many tricks or whatever to change the system. I think we need to crack down on illegal immigrants in the way we in an appropriate way, and I think at the federal level they're going to deal with that. But we have children that live in this country, children that we have, and I agree with the federal law, that we educate in our K-12 system. We have invested in those children, and they deserve the continued investment. And so I want to thank you for bringing this forward. I do have one concern with the bill, and that's on item C. And it's the piece about the affidavit, because I'm wondering if you have, and I'm sure you have given thought, but if you could explain to me how we can protect children from being responsible for turning their families in as illegals when they fill out this form, because as I understand it, this is a form that someone could get their hands on and track down parents, and I would hate for a child to be responsible for somehow causing their parents to be turned in. I think that's something I would not want my children to have to be responsible for, and I would worry about that. So it was just a question. Perhaps you've discussed that, and you could just highlight it. But again, I want to thank you for bringing this forward.
Mariani, you want to respond?
Very quickly, I've never thought of it. We actually added this in because people were expressing concern about investing in students that would not become citizens. And, you know, you heard the young man's desire. That's pretty uniformly expressed, but we wanted to make sure there was a way to document that. I believe there may be data privacy laws that may protect that information from going out, but I'll look into that.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. Representative Moll, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Mariani, thank you for your courage working on this bill and persistence. Let's hope this is the year that we get this passed. Just a couple of points, really, and you can comment them on if you want. You know, I live near Bemidji, and I'm surrounded by three reservations. My friends there often remind me that that we're all immigrants other than them. And so I think that, you know, drawing some arbitrary line someplace just after us is not all that honest. And the other point I'd like to remind people is that, and I teach at Bemidji State University, we don't have out-of-state tuition. Many of the institutions in the state of Minnesota, state schools, don't have it. And this is also just a fairness issue amongst the institutions themselves. University of Minnesota does, a handful of Minsky institutions still do, but most don't now. So I frankly would like to see out-of-state tuition abolished completely, and maybe eventually we'll get there. But I hope we include this, and it's a good first step.
Now, Mr. Chair and members, there are a lot of good policy reasons beyond this one, frankly, even bigger ones, on why we should move toward a uniform tuition rate. You know, we're an aging population. The demographics are shifting away from us. Every state is going to increasingly compete for every educated individual. Just go down to Iowa. They hit this bubble 10, 15 years ago. And they're bending over backwards to bring people into the states. That might be the better way to deal with this issue, quite frankly, down the line. It'll have benefits for many more communities than just this community.
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moe touched on a little bit of my question here. And I was, before I got on this committee, it was an interesting, because I thought out-state tuition was, you know, if you lived out-state, you paid out-state tuition, and there's reciprocity deals that we have made with some of our surrounding states. But then I came to find out about a week ago that, in fact, there are 11 Minsky institutions that do not charge out-state in an effort to recruit talent to the universities. I don't necessarily agree with that process, but that kind of brings to bear what's the reason for this bill, other than to bring uniformity across the higher ed system. And I don't necessarily agree with that view. I spent 22 years in the military, and I served alongside a lot of non-American nationals. And they committed to serve this country for a protracted period of time, sometimes four, sometimes six, sometimes longer years. And they served honorably with the effort of getting a citizenship in this country because it meant so much to them. And I think that that is one of the keys to becoming an American, is you know that when you put your service to your country up front, that that service means something. And for them to make that sacrifice, to commit to 4 to 6 years in the military service and to be under that discipline of the military service, serves to be a benchmark for their citizenship. And I think when we do this type of thing, we do a disservice to those who are willing to step up to the plate and say, you know what, this country means something. So I'm not against immigrants coming into the country, but I think there needs to be a check. It needs to be something that says, you know, if you want to come to this country, you need to invest in this country. And that's more of a statement, Mr. Chair, than a question. I apologize.
Thank you. Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mariani, I just have a question, and maybe you can speak to this or clarify it. But we know that this is a violation of federal law, and the Attorney General of Virginia recently advised Virginia public universities and colleges that federal law precludes grants in in-state tuition to illegal aliens. It says the Attorney General cited the leading case from the California Court of Appeals, which held that a state's legitimate interest in denying in-state tuition to undocumented aliens are manifest and important, and then went on to list the reasons why. And I think I heard testimony earlier that we were having several states were putting this through, but can you speak to this about Virginia and California?
Representative Mariani, any expertise in that area?
Unfortunately, I'm not a lawyer, thank God. Mr. Chair, members.
Especially in front of this chair.
Yes, I knew that. I'm not familiar with that. I can tell you that these state laws have withstood lawsuits repeatedly, that the issue here hinges on and every state has a different statute in terms of defining resident students and therefore resident tuition rates. or out-of-state tuition rates. And so when we looked at the Minnesota state law, it was clear to us that by clarifying, and that's what this does, you know, the high school attendance, the 3 years, you know, et cetera, that would meet the federal standard, if you want to call it that, that was established by the law that was put in place several years ago. So I would have to look at that law. Members, when it comes to public financial aid dollars, that's a whole other issue here. And I don't know if that...
Right. You don't qualify under that.
No citizen, no non-citizen, regardless of their status, qualifies under those circumstances. And this law, proposed law, does not attempt to change that or address that issue at all.
Representative Nornes.
Mr. Chair, I came in a few minutes late. Just was curious what the motion is for this bill or where
just
it will go.
Set it aside. Lay it over for possible inclusion.
Okay.
Okay, no further questions then. Thank you, Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
And everyone else that testified. Representative Walschlager, why don't you... Representative Horman, do you have to go back to another committee? Why don't we have... Okay. Yeah, Representative Hartman, then. Representative Hartman moves that House Bill 1974 be considered to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus higher education finance bill. Representative Hartman, welcome to the committee. Quickly, please, we still have a number of bills to do.
Mr. Chair, thank
you. We have some quiet in here, please. Thank you.
I can talk really loud while they leave. Mr. Chair, this bill is a simple bill. It would appropriate $200,000 for the Loan Repayment Assistance Program to provide assistance for lawyers repaying their loans from law school. If the lawyers choose to do public interest law. And my first job practicing law out of law school was with the Legal Aid Society in Minneapolis. My starting salary was $28,500. Once I had two children in daycare, I was making a dollar an hour. And if I
you
had...
You haven't gone up much since, have you, Representative?
No, it hasn't. I did not have student loans to repay, but if I did, I could not have taken that job. So for students coming out of law school today with much greater debt, this is a very important program. And I have with me Holly Knight, who is a recipient of some assistance from the Loan Repayment Assistance Program. This is a program that currently exists. Members of the bar contribute to the fund, and it does help some lawyers now. The appropriation we're looking at would allow them to help more attorneys. And, Mr. Chair, with that, I'd like to introduce Holly Knight.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Knight. Well, just identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Holly Knight. I'm a staff attorney at the Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services in St. Paul. I'm a 2004 graduate of the University of Minnesota Law School, and since 2004, I've been with Smurls, which some of you may know my office as. When I entered law school in the fall of 2001, it was my goal to work at Legal Aid. I accepted the fact that my debt load would be high when I graduated and that my salary would be low, but these numbers became a little more skewed when my tuition cost at the university increased 30% during my 3 years at law school. Since I've graduated, I know that the law school tuition has increased another 34%. When I graduated from law school, I owed approximately $140,000 in education debt. About $115,000 of this was for law school. My starting salary was $35,000 at legal services. After a little over 2 years, my salary has increased to $40,500. My education debt balance is currently $132,000. My net income monthly is about $2,500, and my monthly loan payment is $1,050, which is about 40% of my net income. I have been fortunate enough to receive financial assistance from LRAP since June of 2005. My current annual award is $4,950. When I graduated in 2004 with the debt load and decided to still apply for legal aid positions, the fact that LRAP was a resource available to me was very significant in my decision to commit to legal aid. As some of you may know, Smurls provides free legal services to low-income persons in civil matters. We serve 33 counties. I work in the St. Paul office, which specifically serves Ramsey, Dakota, Carver, Scott, and Washington counties. I work in the family law unit. We prioritize cases which involve protections of persons from domestic abuse, cases to protect the best interests of children, specifically keeping them with their primary parent, and Indian Child Welfare Act matters. I personally represent clients in order for protection cases, divorces, custody actions, those sorts of things. I recently closed a case which I've been working on for about a year and a half, and I think that this case is a good example of what I do at Legal Aid and an accurate illustration of the kind of obstacles that my clients face. This particular client is a woman. She contacted our office after she fled to Minnesota to get away from her husband. She had been assaulted multiple times during the marriage and hospitalized twice. After the parties married, her husband insisted they move to a state where she did not know anyone. She could not get a job. The physical abuse escalated as my client became more isolated, and she became pregnant. At this time, also, my client was a documented immigrant, but her immigration status depended on her husband, and that was often a threat that he would use. If you leave, if you call the police, I'll have you deported. Finally, in her fifth month of her pregnancy, he brutally assaulted her in their apartment. He stripped her of her clothes, and he locked her out of their apartment in the middle of the winter. I'm sorry. I just really love this woman. After she was released from the hospital, she came to Minnesota with basically nothing. She stayed with her relatives, and she contacted our office. The first thing we were able to do was file for an order for protection. We had a pretty highly contested trial. She was 7 months pregnant at the time. So the court granted an order for protection for a year, which was great. We couldn't file for divorce because she hadn't met the residency requirements at that point. But with the order for protection that we had and the medical records, an immigration attorney from our office was able to file to get her status so that her immigration status would shift off from her husband's and she would be independently a legal permanent resident. In the meantime, her husband filed for divorce in the state that had jurisdiction and asked the court to move back to that state in her third trimester of pregnancy. I was able to work with that county's legal aid office to assist in the case. We worked together and made sure that the case was venued here in Minnesota. Around that time, she also gave birth to a healthy child. Eventually, we had another highly contested divorce case, which focused on the custody of the infant. The final order in that case was recently issued, and the result is incredibly positive. Not only did my client obtain sole custody of the child, the visitation schedule that was ordered ensures that my client and the child will be safe. Her husband was ordered to pay approximately $500 a month in child support and was ordered to pay all of her hospital bills she had incurred as a result of the domestic violence, which totaled almost $10,000. Since then, in the last couple of months, my client's been able to go back to work full-time. She's completely economically self-reliant. At this point, her income is way over our income guidelines, which is great. She's gotten health care for her and her son. Her child's in a licensed daycare, and like I said before, her immigration status is stable and does not have any relation to her husband's. Because LRAP has enabled me to commit to legal aid, I've been able to fully assist this client in most of her legal needs, as well as countless other clients. And the assistance she received from my office helped her and her child become completely self-sufficient and safe. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hartman, I think we have to fix your bill up a little bit. If I could suggest an amendment to you on line 1.7. Between or after the two, we would add the Office of Higher Education for a grant to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So the line would read from the general fund to the Office of Higher Education for a grant to the loan repayment, etc. I believe that would be, it's a 501c3. What is this?
Yes, sir, it's a 501c3.
Okay. Any other questions on the bill? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, wait a minute. Maybe we should. Representative Hartman moves that amendment, that oral amendment. Does everybody understand it? Questions to the amendment? Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Murphy.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Hartman, this grant fund that would be set up is for grants to the attorney to repay their college loans.
That's right.
And what do you envision the cost of a grant would be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, Heather, with the hard to pronounce last name, is here to answer those types of questions.
Welcome to the committee, ma'am. Why don't you just say your name for the team?
Mr. Chair, committee, thank you. My name is Heather Vlieger. I am the Executive Director of the Loan Repayment Assistance Program of Minnesota.
And what would you envision?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy. Our current award is about $4,000 per year, but the annual student loan debt of our attorneys is more like $8,000 to $9,000 a year. So what we'd like to do with this funding that would be commingled with the other funding we're already receiving is provide more loan repayment assistance to the attorneys currently in our program, and then also to expand our program to be serving more legal aid attorneys that are serving low-income clients. We know that 80% of the legal needs of low-income clients are not being met in Minnesota at this time, and with this funding, we'd be able to support more legal aid attorneys to make it possible for them to choose this work and continue in it.
Representative Murphy.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hartman, this program already exists, and where have they received the funds from before?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we've received a broad base of support for a number of years. We've been in existence for 15 years, receiving support from law firms, bar associations, individuals, the Legal Services Advisory Committee, the Lawyers Trust Account Board, law students doing fundraising activities, as well as the law schools themselves. However, in the past year, we've received a more than 30% increase in our applications. We're just seeing a great need for this program, something that we haven't seen in the past. And this is due to the rising costs of law school tuition.
Mr. Chair. I'm especially interested in this because I've been sitting on public safety all these years and listening to the need for increased budgets to the civil legal fund, and this is a little bit different, but you're using the same reasoning, added caseload for the need. And is this the first year that you've asked the state for assistance for this fund?
Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I believe so. I know that the state provides some funding for legal aid for the actual offices and their operations, but this is the first year that the Loan Repayment Assistance Program has asked for money to help repay the loans.
We could send this bill to Paymar's committee, then we.
Well, as long as it didn't go through Mullery's committee, that might work.
Representative Gunther.
To the testifier.
There's two questions I have to ask. One of them is, how does St. Paul become Southern Minnesota? We'll gladly adopt them, but I mean, I was curious about that. And the other one is, what is the difference between legal aid and public defenders? Because you both kind of cover the same area, and I've never been on a judiciary committee of any kind, so I've been before them. Thanks to Representative Murphy, I've always done well.
Do you want to take that, Ms.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, I'll let Heather answer the question about the region that Smurls covers. But as to the difference between a public defender and a legal aid lawyer, legal aid does civil work. Public defenders help people in criminal cases when they can't afford attorney.
Thank you.
And as to the regional area of Smurls, do you know that? I'm guessing budget cuts and consolidations.
We have had to consolidate a lot of our offices, but I think historically, I think Smurls is actually the oldest legal aid organization in the state. I think our St. Paul office is the northernmost office, but we do have 10 offices spread out from Worthington, Mankato, Albert Lee, and we serve all 33 southernmost counties.
Thank you for that clarification.
Representative Gunther, now that we got the bill in our possession, we could move the office to Fairmont.
I think it's a great idea.
Okay. Any further questions, then? If not, thank you all for your testimony.
Thank you.
And then we have amended it to correct we have in front of us. Thank you. And Representative Haas moves the minutes of the 31st meeting. It seems like 85. 35th first meeting of the Higher Education Committee. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? If not, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Representative Walshlager, Representative Welty moves that House File 1253 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the Higher Education Omnibus and Workforce Development Committee, or bill. Excuse me, Representative Walshlager, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Rukavina and members. This House file is for purposes of appropriating $250,000 for fiscal year 2008 for a grant to Augsburg College for the purpose of its step-up program, which provides educational opportunities to chemically dependent students. This is a one-time appropriation. Now, you may be wondering the connection. I am an Augsburg College graduate and certainly a parent of college-age students. With me here today to testify is Dave Haddon, who is the assistant director of the Step Up program. I'd like to mention just a few points that are or made me be really passionate about this program. First of all, the students have successfully completed a chemical dependency treatment program and have a minimum of 6 months of sobriety. It's a unique college program. It's been in existence for about 10 years. 300 students have been through this program. And here's what the issue is. Right now, they have about 50 students, and they need some dollars to get up to 80 students, which is the threshold for making it sustainable. Now, this is a national model, best in the country. Augsburg College is in the process of helping other schools. So this is why I feel very strongly about this, and I'll now have Mr. Haddon provide some more details. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is David Haddon. I'm the assistant director of the Augsburg College Step Up program, which has been in existence for 10 years now. It's actually over 350 young people that we have served over the course of 10 years. Before coming to Augsburg, what I did for a living was I did educational vocational assessments for young people that were chemically dependent on the issues, how do you move on and how do you put your life together. I did that for Hazleton for 7.5 years. The program was, in some respects, a partnership between those two institutions. Over the 10 years, 84% of these students have remained clean and sober in the program. And this is young people that have been diagnosed with addiction, but also dual diagnosis issues, learning issues. And so it's not just one thing these young people are dealing with. This is truly a group of young people that are high risk. The GPA, 2.85, but we also include the students that don't stay clean and sober. That's 2.85, and so these are young people that traditionally have been failing out of school. They don't have a great track record, but what we do is we work with them, and we work with them intensely. We have a leadership model that's very successful. The other thing is that the University of Minnesota Department of Psychiatry, Ken Winters, is our evaluator. He'll be presenting at the Joint Adolescent Meeting on Treatment Effectiveness in Washington, D.C. on April 26. I think that what we have is we have a cutting-edge program. We're also in the development of a manual and quality assurance standards that other schools are going to be taking a look at. We get calls from schools all the time. We've also co-founded an association called the Association of Recovery Schools. When we started, there were three college programs. There are nine programs that have started since that time. So we have 12 college programs in total. In addition to that, some of the side things that we've been involved with is supporting the University of Minnesota, and we have a small effort there to help them to begin to how do you deal with young people that have chemical dependencies and how do you help move them into recovery. Our model simply, it's a leadership model. It's a citizenship model. It's teaching young people that sometimes did not behave 100% of what we'd like them to do. It's teaching them how to become citizens, teaching them how to academically succeed. And again, our program, over 10 years, 84% of our students have stayed clean and sober with us. I'm writing letters for young people to get into medical school. I've got kids over in law school right now. And these were typically kids that did not do well. That's really the overview of our program.
Thank you very much. I've heard about this and think it's a wonderful program. And if the committee decides to fund some of this or all of it, and I would hope that maybe in return you would be more than willing to share your quality program with other institutions here in this state. So.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, some of the things that we are looking at right on the side is we've helped a little place called University House get going. It's a sober house for young students that are going to the University of Minnesota. A spinoff of that is a new organization called Sober. It's for students in recovery. We're also working with Boynton Health Services, and we've actually given them some of our graduates that are in grad school now and help the University of Minnesota to help build some standards with young people. And so part of it is a partnership model, and that is part of our intent.
That's great.
I'd like to add, Chair and members, I lost my train of thought.
Well, that's okay. It's time for the rest to move on. Then. Thank you very much.
I just remembered.
We have two more bills. Thank you very much.
I just remembered.
Hurry up.
I'm sorry. We had probably 10 students who wanted to come today and share their story. You're making me laugh. You know, in the
the
thinking about time, I can't even think right now. You know, we just said, you know, no, we'll just go with Mr. Haddon here. So now I'm thoroughly embarrassed. I'd like to leave. Hope you support it.
Thank you. It was a very worthwhile testimony. Thanks for your...
It's so rare that I lose my train of thought in words. That
well, this committee has a habit of doing that. Representative Broad. House File 1349, Representative Severson moves that House File 1349 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Broad, welcome to the committee. You're substituting, pinch hitting. If you can do it quickly, we might consider it.
Mr. Chairman, in that case, this bill essentially will provide for a India Center at the University of Minnesota. I'd be happy to give you as much information as you wish. But essentially, we just can't ignore the fact that we have a global economy, and India is becoming a bigger and bigger player in this economy throughout the world. The population growth and the economic opportunities and partnerships are, I think, limitless. And so, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, with that, I'll respond to questions as well as I can. I am pinch hitting. I'm a little faster than Representative Paulson, but I'm not sure if I can actually direct where the ball goes.
Any questions? There is a China Center, I believe, that had gotten some funding along with private funding. Representative Bryan.
Mr. Chair, that was exactly my question. What other centers are there at the university?
That's one of them, and I think they're in the base, too. And then we're going to start a Croatian and Italian center, too. Maybe we'll piggyback
Chairman,
onto this bill. Representative Braun.
Mr. Chairman, being a Scot and a Swede, I certainly would be interested in talking with you about those things. But there is a China Center, and if we look at where the population growth and look at where some economic activities are, the China Center, I think, at the University of Minnesota has been there since 1979 and has been working very well. And essentially what this is intended to do is to be modeled right after the China Center, just recognizing the importance of India as a player on the world economy.
Representative Murphy,
what
to your bill or to this bill?
To this bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
What is the appropriation that we
He had asked
China
for,
Center?
It's a blank appropriation.
My question
the
is
Chinese is $250 in the base or fine?
Mr. Chairman.
You know?
I do, Mr. Chairman. It's actually today my understanding is that the China Center receives $250,000 in state appropriations and raises about $400,000 privately. So there's a nice mesh between state and private dollars going to fund that program.
Okay. Thank you very much. No further questions. Thank you then.
Thank you.
Representative Murphy, can you move? Are you a full member of this committee or an honorary?
I can't move.
Oh. Well, then I will. I will move. Representative Rukavina will move that House File 1676 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Welcome to the committee. Obviously, you are not Bill.
Christy Tornquist. Dr. Christy Tornquist is the director of the Minitex, or is the speaker for the Minitex. Funding request for the university and the colleges, and but it also, it's the backbone of the library system and the technology system for the university and colleges across the state, but for our regional libraries and city libraries also. And Dr. Turnquist can speak better than I about the issue of needing more money.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon to all of you. I'm Christy Turnquist, and I serve as Dean of Learning Resources and Technology Services at St. Cloud State University. In that capacity, I'm responsible for the library operations on our campus. I'm here today to speak in support of House File 1676, which provides for a $1.7 million annual increase to the Minutex base budget. But first of all, I would like to take a moment to thank all of you on this committee, as well as the legislature as a whole, for their ongoing support for Minutex. It's a very important program for libraries in the state. In fact, I believe this is one of the most cost-effective programs in the state, and that's why I wish to speak to you about it today. In brief, Minutex provides information resources for publicly funded and private colleges and university students and faculty. And you've been given some materials in a packet, I believe. And given our time, I'm not going to attempt to cover all the different services that Minutex provides, but I am going to try to explain one as an example. My example today is that Minutex licenses databases. The bulk of the information resources our students want and need to be successful in their academic careers are available online, typically in very expensive databases. These databases include online collections of scholarly full-text journals, newspapers, magazines, reference resources, and electronic books. They cover multiple disciplines, including the sciences, medicine, education, the arts, business, and social sciences. And this is the part that's near and dear to my heart. Last year, Minutex licensing saved St. Cloud State University $1.8 million in fees, allowing us to provide cost-effective access to the resources for our students. $1.8 million is significantly more than my total annual budget for all collections at St. Cloud State. Across the state of Minnesota, Minutex licensing saved Minsky libraries over $16.5 million and all Minnesota academic institutions $29 million last year alone. And as a taxpayer in the state of Minnesota, $29 million sounds like a lot of money to me. As I mentioned earlier, these databases include materials our students need to be successful in their academic programs and in their careers. A good example is accreditation of our nursing program at St. Cloud State University. We're required to have medical databases to maintain our accreditation standards. Funding those databases without the support of Minutex would be cost prohibitive if each institution in the state with a nursing program was to license the databases individually. That $20 million savings that I mentioned is a return on only a small part of what Minutex does with its current $4,381,000. The other cooperative programs described in those materials you received, interlibrary loan and borrowing from the University of Minnesota's library collection, the Daily Courier Delivery Service, the Electronic Library of Minnesota, or ELM, MinLink, and the Minnesota Digital Library, all these drive down costs for individual libraries. These services provide access to information ranging from paper formats to newly digitized photographic collections of historical materials in Minnesota. For example, on my campus, again, over 5,000 books and journal articles were received from the University of Minnesota through Minutex each year. These are items I don't have to buy directly out of my own budget. So the cost savings to state taxpayers, to higher education institutions, and ultimately to our students as a result of all these services is immense. Now, the bad news in all of this is the cost of these services continues to increase, and Minutex has had decreasing and or stable funding for the past few years. Without an increase in their funding, the services that Minutex provides will be dramatically less next year and similarly the following year. This means that campuses will have to pick up the differences at higher costs or do without the information our students need. In conclusion, I believe that Minutex should be considered a model for state government at its best. They facilitate shared resources that provide access for all, the haves and the have-nots. They leverage statewide purchasing power to make basic resources available, improving the quality of instruction for college and university students in Minnesota, and they deliver new information formats in cost-effective and efficient ways. I thank you for your time today, and again, I thank you for your past support of Minitex. I urge you to consider full funding for this request. The return on investment in our students will be tremendous. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Reinhart and then Gunn.
Mr. Chair, not really a question, just a supportive comment. I think this is an extraordinary service, and I know it to be used very broadly by all facets of Minnesota society. So I think it's one of the greatest investments we can make.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe this also goes to high schools and mm-hmm. and private schools, and it's one of the biggest computer programs in the state.
Yes.
Ms. Marquis, go ahead.
I'm sorry. That's thank okay. you. Yes, different aspects of it go to different parts. So the ELM, the Electronic Library of Minnesota, goes to all citizens that have a library card in any library in the state. So this is a cost-effective way to get that information to everybody in the state, actually.
Great program.
And Mr. Chair, I would like to reiterate what Dr. Turnquist said about how it does serve all the college students, and it is serving to help reduce the tuition. It's helping to reduce their student loans that they have to make because they can't afford it as individuals for us not to make this investment. I've heard from librarians across the state about the need to support this. I especially heard from a local librarian said the courier service was so important. I heard from another local librarian on Saturday when she heard I was in the building. She says, oh, yes, you've just got to help Minitex. And that was the local regional library in Duluth. And they just all need the services of Minitex, and we've got to keep our support of it, in my opinion.
Well, maybe, Ms. Turnquist, if I help you get some extra money. The other day when I was cleaning up, I found a book from the Virginia Library that I must not have returned from 1978. Can you help with the...
I'll take care of that for you, sir.
With fines. Which is not a tax.
Right, sign your deed. Like I said, that Seinfeld episode, the John's going to come and rest me or something. Well, okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. And members, we thank you, Ms. Turnquist. We meet on Monday night. No, not tonight. Tonight at 6 o'clock. You got me scared there for a minute. 6 o'clock. We got a full agenda. We're going to wrap it up, I think, with Representative Gunther's department bill. Pardon me? Oh, in the middle we moved them up to? No, we're going to make them stay till the end. Members, we'll see you later then. This meeting, can we recess? Yeah, let's reset. Then you can have one set a minute. We're in recess until 6. Yeah.
You'd have to begin again at 1.18.
Right. Is that... Council, help us with this.
Just Mr. Chairman, I believe you want to delete all of Section 1, including the effective date, because that's only the effective date for that section.
Okay. You heard the motion then to delete Section 1 of the bill. Any questions, comments? I'm curious, but I won't even ask. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Any questions on the bill?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I actually have, Representative Loeffler, I have a small amendment that Representative Loeffler would like added. University has no objection. This is to essentially add the Northeast, a Tier 2, what we call a Tier 2 area, which is to have the planning, not the funding, but the planning go a few blocks north of this, ends right now in the southeast area, but there's been, as Representative Loeffler points out, an enormous effect also on the rental housing and transportation in the northeast area. And so we think, so Representative Loeffler has, I actually expected that this was going to be done in the Senate, but it wasn't, but Representative Loeffler would like this added to the bill, too.
Anyway. Members,
Representative Poppy moves that Representative Slocum might want to move this one. Representative Slocum moves the H2074A1 amendment. I can see what you're doing. Just out of curiosity, how many, how big of area does this incorporate then?
This
add on,
it's
on
northeast. It's
undetermined. So are we at Bloomington yet with this? Or
what? It's undetermined. It's an undetermined area because it's the parts of northeast which have heavy student.
So it's still dealing with student population.
It's contingent.
Okay. Any questions on the amendment? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Now we have the bill as amended, and we will lay it over for possible inclusion. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Members, Representative Kahn, and thank you, Mr. Jones, and thank you, ma'am. Okay, Representative Moe, House File 1508. Representative Moe moves that House File 1508 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion. And Representative Moe, you want the delete all amendment amended right away? Is that what we're going to be talking?
Yeah, we'll work from the delete all amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Moe moves the delete all amendment H1508DE3.
Now 7 more amendments. Go back.
And Representative Moe has an oral amendment to incorporate into this. Would you read the amendment? To what?
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment is on page 2 of the bill after line 30, insert clause D that reads, for the purposes of this section, mass market and trade books that are not published, marketed, or sold primarily for use in or by post-secondary institutions are excluded.
Mr. Chairman, I can also explain the amendment.
We'll incorporate that, and then we're going to get it copied for the committee and for the audience so they can look at what you're doing. But why don't you just incorporate that in your delete all amendment. And so you've heard the motion with the incorporating language in clause D on page 2. All those in favor signify. Are there any questions on that? We'll have that language for everybody. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And if the page then could come, one of the pages, and make some copies so we can get this to the members. Go ahead. Start the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One small other. Again, we've been working with the interested stakeholders, so we've been making some changes to make this as palatable as possible. The last oral amendment I'd like to make on line page 3, line 3, B, the bookstore, it says must notify students. Instead of must notify, strike must notify and insert make available to.
Must make available
no,
to?
Just not must, but the bookstore. Oh, yes, correct. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Must make available to.
You've heard that motion. Any questions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Are we done now, Representative
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will just talk briefly about the bill and the process, and then I will let some testifiers give more detail. This, as a faculty member, this is very inspiring to see college students primarily leading the effort to come up with a national model for having accountability in textbook pricing. It's been very inspiring to me to see them go to work on this, and they've been in contact with legislators from around the country, and Senator Coleman's office now has asked to model legislation after the work that our college students have done. So again, it's extremely inspiring. We've heard testimony here before about the exorbitant cost of textbooks, and the unnecessary changes that have been, that are made oftentimes, or apparently unnecessary changes that the college students first and foremost have to make, have to pay for. They borrow money, increase their debt load, and this is a very effective attempt, I think, to do a few things. Primarily, for the students to disclose to them and to the faculty institutions what the changes are to the textbooks, so we can know if actually new additions are warranted. And then the second portion of this is to create a pilot program for textbook rental. I think these books aren't used very much in each class. As a faculty member, I wish they were used more. and they're very usable for ensuing semesters. So we would like to create a pilot project for textbook rental. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Scott Formo, the Student Association President.
Welcome to the committee, Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the record, my name is Scott Formo, President of the Minnesota State College Student Association. There's a couple of handouts that I believe the committee members all have. One is an unmarked up copy of just a textbook fact sheet. Another one is a copy of a PowerPoint that we put together with the intention of, you know, presenting some of the issues and why this legislation has, how this can benefit students and how it kind of works. In light of time tonight, I've been asked to keep it down, so instead of going through all 42 slides in the PowerPoint, I've incorporated on the front of the PowerPoint itself a table of contents which kind of outlines what the different areas of the PowerPoint are. I'd just like to run through that real fast. The slides on pages 3 through 5 are the current practices that bookstores, institutions, faculty members, students, and publishers are currently doing in the industry. Slides 16 through 17 is an example of a publisher's website. What I did there, just so that committee members are aware of the fact that one of the current practices that publishers are currently doing is that they do provide this information on their websites. And what I did was I took one of my textbooks, which was my economics textbook from McGraw-Hill, and I went to their website and I went through all the different areas of the website that I would have to click on in order to find this information. And as you can see, it took 9 different slides to get about half of the information that this legislation would ask them to put all in one place, so that the faculty members will know everything that they need to know ahead of time instead of having to go through multiple locations on the website to try to dig for the information. Slide 18 just talks about the publisher's websites, what we would like to see them do and what this legislation would direct them to do with the disclosure aspect of it. Slides 19 through 22 are just some current advertising examples. When you talk about other industries that currently advertise, or whether it be websites or whatever, they do put all of the information out front many times. For example, the first slide that I have there is a new car sticker. When you go to purchase a new car at a car lot, you can look at what the basic provisions of that car are, what you get for it, what the mileage is, that kind of stuff. You can see what all the alternative options are. You can see what the prices are, what you're getting for what you're paying, and what you can add to it. Another example that I used is a fast food menu board. When you go up to a McDonald's or something like that, you can look at their value meals and what they're suggesting to give you a better price. But at the same point in time, they list everything individually as far as if you just want a sandwich or something to drink. That's what the current advertising examples are, just showing other industries that use this type of practice when they're marketing their materials. And then slides 23 through 33 show some potential savings to students and how this legislation could actually benefit students. There again, I took 2 of my textbooks. One of them was the economic textbook that I talked about earlier, and the other one was a textbook that, or a bundled package that's used for keyboarding in 2 different courses. There's a keyboarding 1 and a keyboarding 2. And the potential savings, had this information been available, had it been available to purchase separately, different things like that, how I could have saved over $200 on just those 2 textbooks alone had this legislation been enacted and been followed. Slides 34 through 39 just kind of gives you an overview of the legislation itself and what the different areas of the legislative pieces are. And the last 3 slides is kind of a summary talking about the educational aspect of it. And that's one piece that I feel is probably one of the most important pieces of this legislation, is that we've, coming out of the textbook task force recently, there was a report that I believe has already been through this committee talking about the best practices measures that everybody can take in order to lower the cost to students. We've worked with the Office of Higher Education, and they have agreed to work with the post-secondary institutions, students, faculty, publishers, and all of the stakeholders, bookstores in this group, and create some educational materials as to how these best practices can be implemented, what the different provisions of this law are, and how you can actually make a difference for affecting students. And so that's where I think the educational piece is one of the biggest components, is making sure that everybody knows how the system should work properly in order to provide those savings to students. The publisher summary talks about why the importance of every stakeholder in this group, especially the publishers, why that disclosure piece is important, how it affects faculty members and the choices that they make when they're looking at what materials to have students purchase for the courses. And the last part is just a summary of the rental program as far as how a rental program can benefit students. We've done some different research from different rental programs across the country. One of them that sticks in my mind is the University of Wisconsin rental program, who currently charges, I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but it's right around $75 to $80 per semester for their students for rental programs. And even when you get into the graduate degrees, it's between $8 and $9 per credit for the rentals of their books. Now, when you talk about the testimony that you've heard earlier, in the session here, you know, students are spending anywhere from $400 to $600 a semester. If that cost could be cut down to under $100 for a full-time student or even $8 a credit for graduate students, that could provide some substantial savings. Now, I do realize that the upfront cost of a rental program based off of the numbers we've heard coming up from national reports, the upfront cost to properly put together a rental program is about $1,000 per student. What we've tried to do with this piece of legislation is get at least one pilot program implemented in the state of Minnesota, in one of the Minsky campuses. And through that, currently we're asking for the state to put part of that money up front, part of that $1,000 up front for the upfront cost to help Minsky purchase textbooks and start the program. But then through the rental fees and stuff that they could charge students, by them putting the rest of the money up front, they would be able to recoup that over a 1 or 2 year period. So that kind of gives you an overview of that also. We did also run this legislation just recently past the Student Advisory Council at the Office of Higher Education. And when we did, what that group is made up of is it's the leaders of the different student associations across the state. And from the Student Advisory Council, Daniel Moore, the chair of the University of Minnesota Student Senate, and their representative on the Student Advisory Council has approved moving forward with this legislation on behalf of the 64,000 students from the University of Minnesota. I have approved it on behalf of the 100,000 students from the Minnesota State College Student Association. Justin McMartin is in favor of it on behalf of their 60-some thousand students in the Minnesota State University Association. And Zach Vogelin from the private proprietary schools has also approved this. Kelsey, who is the other student representative on SAC, was unable to be at that meeting that day, so we have not heard from her yet, but 4 out of the 5 groups sitting on, or members sitting on that council have approved this legislation, so I just wanted to state that for the record, that we do have very strong student support from all across the state. And with that, I would be more than happy to answer any questions, and you may want to wait with that until after the other testifier, but thank you.
Are there any questions right now of the witness or of the proposal as amended here? If not, you stick around. I'm sure, Mr. Foreman, we'll have you come back up if we need you. Mr. Hildebrand. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Hildebrand.
Thank you.
Welcome to Minnesota, if you're not from here.
No, sir, but I have been here 9 times in the last 7 months.
Well, that's good economic development.
Yeah.
This committee is about?
My name is Bruce Hildebrand. I'm with the Association of American Publishers in Washington, and thank you for letting me speak. I see Cheryl Maplethorpe up there. I got to know her very well. I attended all six of her task force meetings. And I met with your students last week, the ones who are proposing this legislation or pushing it, for a couple of hours to go over some of the language. We just received this language a few minutes ago. I must tell you, we are for transparency. I've helped write a lot of these bills that are going around the country. This bill has got some specific problems that, frankly, cannot be met. They're asking for materials. If you look, for example, at 221 through 5 there, please understand, this represents, and I'll talk about this more in a moment, this printout right here represents a single textbook and all of the components that go with it. Now, if you start talking as this language would say that you should prepare a report anytime someone asks of every change in this textbook and all the associated technologies that go with it, it would fill up this room. So let's say we get, we're going to start having to ship trainloads of these reports in here. It would incredibly increase the price of textbooks. There's some other problems here at 228. I think they're mixing up what a bookstore is and what a publisher is. So anyway, we'll help them with the language. We'll provide specificity. We talked drafts too generally last time. We're very willing to help them fix it. But there's a couple of things that was mentioned in the testimony here. As I said, publishers are absolutely for transparency. We have to be. We market. We are private businesses selling in a private market to a highly selective audience called college faculty. And they are picky, they're choosy, they're tough, and they're demanding. Now, if you look at this, represents one book, or one, the parts of one book. It's Introductory Psychology. It's the most popular one in the country. But there are 215 competing Introductory Psychology books. I think we've got some materials here we wanted to hand out. We'll outline that for you. But we're talking 216 books for one course at prices ranging at retail from $23.50 to $120.50. And the fact that doesn't include the electronic books, the hybrid books, or the custom books. So there's probably, all told, maybe a faculty member might see 5,000 options for this one course. The disconnect is the student sees what the faculty has chosen, and their choice becomes new, used, or don't buy the book. But that's what we choose faculty to do, is make these decisions. They choose the textbooks, and we pay them to do it because they're supposed to be the experts. And they push us very hard to get the materials they need. In this piece we're going to hand out, I just want to mention the fact that, one, there's this huge thing about all these new textbooks. This report was handed out in your own task force here, and I'll be happy to get you copies by the Used Textbook Association, that points out over a period of 4 years, only 4.5% of the 178,000 books they sold were actually issued in new edition. 4.5%. So the tail is wagging the dog on this debate. And I think we need to recognize that. Technologies are moving a lot faster in print. And frankly, we don't print books. We have people print them for us. We're in the content business. We'd love to sell it all to you online. So anyway, we're happy to work with the bill. We're happy to seek transparency. We're happy to provide you with any information you want. But some of this language is mixed, it's unclear, and it needs to be fixed. That's all I want to say.
Mr. Chairman? I'll let Representative Moore respond before we open it up to questions. Representative Moore.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as a faculty member, I just want to remind you the testimony that we've heard in this committee. We have several examples, and in my own course material, textbooks that have cover changes, indices changes, and preface changes, very little else that are marketed as new textbooks. That's what we're trying to get at. Students are no longer able to use previous editions. And I guess I have to take exception to a couple of the supposed inconsistencies or things that they are not able to accomplish. It is also very clear that we would prefer that these changes be posted on a website. If they're not able to do that, there's an or there. If they're not able to do that, then this written form that is somewhat painfully provided here would be another option for the publishers. But we would prefer to have these things made electronic to students. So that's not, I don't think, very onerous an ask. But I'll respond to other points later.
50,000 pages would be difficult in any form. We'd shut down computers. Remember, too, there are 4,500 publishers The University of Minnesota bookstore, Mr. Crabb, are you here, has over 100,000 titles in that bookstore, provided by over 4,000 publishers. They run from multinational to mom and pop. Some textbooks are sold without ISBN numbers, ironically. I only learned that recently. So it's nice to lay down a blanket. These are private businesses, and the fact that we are debating here in this hearing how a private business designs its website, I can't see you bringing Ford Motor Company in here and telling them, well, we're not sure we have to click too many times to get all the information we want on our website. I mean, these are multi-million dollar websites designed by the big publishers. The little guys don't even have them. So how are we going to enforce this across that spectrum? It's going to be very, very difficult. There'll probably be 10 or 15 publishers in the country that can approach what any of this is being asked for. The rest of them are going to fall off, and they're just not going to be able to respond. And if there's teeth enough to hurt them, their only recourse will be to pull their books out of your state. The little guys can't make it.
Mr. Chairman, would you prefer that I rebut or just wait for questions?
Why don't we just have some questions, and then you can take off. And Mr. Hildebrand, next,
yes.
Can you go through me when you start? I didn't recognize it, but that's okay. I'll let you go.
I'm sorry.
We took Ford Motor Company on last week. And it's Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the rental library or the rental textbook concept. Do you provide any books as a publisher to Wisconsin?
Yes, ma'am.
I guess how into the Wisconsin college system? How does that work for you, in your perspective?
We're very happy to sell the books.
And how often do you sell them new supplies of books or new editions?
Generally, they used to do it on an average of 3 years, but they found that the book's value plummeted after that in the wholesale resale market. So now they're trying to move to 2 years. They also found that they could get more faculty buy-in if they would not hold the faculty to using the books for more than 2 years. There's huge studies out there. The faculty, overwhelmingly prefer their newer textbooks, particularly if they come with new technologies. The economics are what drive the rental programs. It's not the publishers. We're more than happy to supply them, and they can buy the books cheaper from us directly because they don't have to go through, in many cases, a middleman. Sometimes they go through the bookstore, but generally I think a lot of it's bought directly, which we sell wholesale.
Mr. Chair, just another question on that topic. How does the technology then, how do the students, if a textbook comes with a CD, how do you handle that?
It depends on whether it's, some textbook, I have an example up there, it's actually the CD is the subject and the textbook supplements it. So that's always comes as a unit. If it's what's known as supplemental or what the kids call bundle, then the kids have to buy those separately generally because the bookstore or whatever entity is managing it can't handle those one-time use materials or like a graded online homework program that goes with a textbook. So the students buy the trade books like The Sun Also Rises, for example. So you got an English course and you got six textbooks that go with it with your lit book or something. They'll buy those separate. So it's not just straight rental. It's the core books generally where they're trying to put hybrid programs together. It's three or four or five of the very core freshman and sophomore books.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hildebrand, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
We have Commander Severson and I was a radarman in the Navy, and we made constant checks and changes in books all the time, and last I heard, the Navy is a pretty substantial-sized organization, and we have tons of books. And when we had a change that happened to have in one book, they would give us those changes. If there were little changes, we'd write them in just like we do in an amendment. If there were substantial changes, like a whole chapter, they would send us just that chapter. And it was a very efficient, very economical way of changing that. If the Navy changed these big, thick communication books we had, every time there's a little change, they changed the whole book, I don't think we could afford the taxes. Oh. So why can't we customize algebra, would you say psychology?
Mm-hmm.
Psychology is a very subjective discipline. And you have different people, every different professor has different ideas completely.
Yes.
But in geometry, algebra, history, countless other disciplines, they don't change that much. They change a little bit. So all those books we're talking about there, why can't we just give small changes in an envelope for $2.75 to change a book and upgrade it to the new book status?
Mr. Hilton, Representative Gunther, we change history around here all the time.
No, we don't.
That's a whole different issue. Mr. Hilderman.
One, it hasn't worked. Two, it's happening online where it is happening, particularly in the medical sciences, particularly in chemistry, things of that nature. These things are particularly fast-moving subjects, including some of your maths, where the technologies and the applications. I always like the thing about calculus. They used to track a ship, sailing ship. Now they do rocket ships. The applications and the computer technologies that go with them change rather radically. The reason this is so important when I was showing you that one intro site book is that every time one part moves, it may move 20 others. It has been tried. It's expensive. The faculty don't like it. The students lose the pieces. It's one of the reasons they produce a lot of one-time use books with tear-outs. It's the only way they can get the students to bring the materials to the class. And the faculty choose to order those books that way. But there are cost reasons and there are teaching reasons, or they would do it, because it would be easier for them.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hildebrand.
Yes, sir.
I look at this little handout here, and they're showing what they're paying for books. Now, I know I went to college a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't change books. In fact, I had some books that were probably 10 years old when I bought them secondhand. But I look at this, the numbers they have here. I look at the size of college loans, and if professors can't figure out a way to do it better, we're going to have to do it for them. Because right now, I look at the inexpensiveness of making changes. If you have changes in one chapter, I'm even willing to replace that whole chapter. Not the whole book. You mentioned chemistry. The periodic tables hasn't changed forever. Some of the compounds, however, have.
One of the biggest pressures of late has been lightweight material. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Like a conversation here. Can I respond, sir?
You sure can.
Okay.
You obviously already have. So go ahead.
But
if you could, Mr. Emmer, I don't think Representative Gunther was done talking. So.
Oh, okay.
I just would love to hear your response to why they can't, if they just change one chapter, why they can't do that after 4 years of using that book.
Mr. Hildebrand.
Sir, I've got this study here right now. Over a period of 5+ years, a grand total of 13.7% of all textbooks were altered. Now, there are some. Recently, I was in a discussion between an architectural textbook seller and a chemistry and an engineering, and they were all being pressured heavily to change their textbooks to accommodate lightweight materials. One the compounds, the other the use, and the other is the engineering. And they were all saying, we don't want to reprint because it costs too much. So there are cross pressures against this. But the other principal pressure, sir, is if you do not revise your books within a reasonable period of time, the faculty will not choose your books, and that book will go off the market. Only about 30% of all books that are ever published are ever republished because the market won't take them.
One last question. Go ahead, Rep.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hildebrand, I think we can put pressure on college professors in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. I think we can change the way they do business. I think also that the book company, we can't change those, but the book company that comes out with textbooks that allows things like that to happen so our students don't go in debt any more than they have to, is going to be smiled at very much by those professors eventually.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the witness. You had made a statement that there's pressure on the professors every couple of years, and this is just to kind of follow up on the previous question, but there's pressure every couple of years to revise their textbook. Is there any kind of incentive or is there any kind of kickback? Is there anything that would cause the professors to actually change the textbook even though it's adequate for the courses that they're teaching at the time?
Mr. Hildebrand, go ahead.
The response I can give best is the one that Zogby International found in their study, and that is that by an overwhelming majority, it's not that they're being pressured to buy the books, it's that they are choosing new books, is they are pressuring in the reverse direction the publishers. They want new tools, new technologies. One of the greatest growth areas, to cover both your statements, is custom books. We've all been there where we had the 40-page or 40-chapter textbook. The faculty wanted five of them, and that's all they used, and we felt like we'd been ripped off. Well, now the faculty can go online to any of the major publishers and with a mouse and in 15 minutes create their own book for their own content. And since we're not in the printing business, we're in the content business, the price of the book plummets. And so the big driver right now in the industry is to do what you're looking for in terms of price. The students like these books because they're efficient. There are two chief complaints, not price first, but use first. And if they find that they use the book effectively and they use all of it, the complaints just bottom out. So that is going to be a major thing. The other thing, the world is going digital. The concerns that you're expressing here about new textbooks, new technology, new print runs, I think in the very near future, its inertia falls away. That there are more e-book titles available, but the students are not really accepting the full thick text as an e-book yet. So several of the big tech companies are trying to develop a reader that will become the equivalent of a textbook, and the price will plummet.
Okay, Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of quick points. I would like to point out that this legislation is supported by IFO, our faculty union. We recognize Representative Gunther's point that we need to be part of the solution, and we also need to be held accountable to choose our textbooks in a responsible and a timely way so our students can get the best price or the lowest cost when they purchase books. The other point I'd like to make is that the handwritten amendment is also a compromise we worked out with faculty from the University of Minnesota for purposes of making sure that they're part of the solution as well. And I don't know if you want to speak to this or not, but probably won't be speaking in opposition because of the work that we've made. So I don't know if you want to come on down and recognize that or not.
Welcome to committee.
My name is Martin Sampson. I'm the faculty liaison from the University of Minnesota. I'm in the political science department. I teach a course on American foreign policy. Textbook in that area is $65. I've been lucky. I've been teaching 30 years. 30 years ago, textbook was very inexpensive. It was so inexpensive that I assigned two the first time I taught and said, you know, start with whichever one you want, and then we'll think about different ways that people have kind of construed the field. You can't do that anymore. I'm currently teaching a course on U.S. policy toward the Middle East. It's an advanced four-credit course. It has about 2,000 pages of reading, 7 books, about 20 articles from journals. Used to be students had to pay for the articles. You'd go to a Kinko's place, you paid permissions and so forth. Well, that's all free now. It's downloaded through the e-subscriptions of the library, and that has something to do with Minitex. Minsky universities have the same kind
of
access.
We heard him today, Mr. Sam.
It's an amazingly good program. The books cost at Amazon.com, when I checked 3 weeks ago, $83, including shipping, for 7 books. The University of Minnesota bookstore has stocked them. It's a few dollars more than that. How do I do that? I do that through trade books, and I'm in a field where I can do that. So, you know, you have up-to-date kinds of things. Why a textbook costs 4 times what a trade book costs, I don't understand. In some cases, a trade book may be an award-winning thing, lots of copies are published. But in other cases, like Iran's nuclear program, you know, there's not a whole lot of demand for a book like that. And yet still it costs $15 or something of that sort. So in some fields, there's been a way around the textbooks. That doesn't work in all fields. And the thing that really perplexes me is why, in my own field, textbook costs are so enormously high. Why is it that in a field where the books have to keep changing because the topic keeps changing, number one, they're very long, and number two, they cost 4 times what a trade book of equivalent length might cost? I'm perplexed. And I think some kind of pressure that encourages publishers to be a little more forthcoming about price and things of that sort is a good way to go. I'll just close by saying that 2 weeks ago I got a very glossy postcard in the mail from a publisher new edition of a book. It's a very good book, good publisher. I looked at it twice. There was no price on the postcard. I then called, and I waited to get through the phone tree, and finally got somebody, and the person said, it's coming out in the summer, it'll cost $65. Well, I don't understand why the price is not on that postcard. Part of the problem, I think, is university faculty, college faculty, and I think there are things we can do. But there also are some other kinds of things that it seems to me are worth consideration of a state legislature.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Sampson? Thank you. Representative Slocum.
It's too bad we can't urge all the college professors or a really smart Minsku College or University of Minnesota to go to Minitech, put their texts and everything online. The kids have a library card they use to log on or some kind of code to log on. End of problem. Don't buy the book. You know?
Well, maybe some of these suggestions will be worked on. We obviously have a problem. Representative Moe, anything to wrap it up, or are you done?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for all your time and members of the committee. And, again, thank you to the students and others and publishers who actually worked to get us as close as we got.
Mr. Hildebrand, you have anything else to add?
No, it's been a pleasure. This has been the best hearing I've been in 27 states.
Thank you. We were very kind here. It's good to know. And would OHE or the Office of Higher Education or anybody from Minsku care to comment, since you are in the bill, as far as what your opinion might be? Nobody wants to come down and talk, or is nobody here? Oh, yeah, somebody's here.
Well, where's Janice?
He doesn't have the authority. He doesn't get paid enough for this one. But, okay. Well, Mr. Hildebrand, I suggest if you've got some problems with some of the things, you continue to work with the Representative Moe and the students and whoever else wants to be involved in this from our higher education organization, because I have a strong suspicion that both sides of the aisle want to try to do something to help the students on this.
Them in the hall, and we will be working with
thank
them.
You for that. Yes. Okay. Thank you all for your testimony. Representative Dominguez, why don't you come down, Representative Dominguez? And we've got House File 924. And members, I think this bill doesn't have any financial implications, so we are going to vote this bill either out of here or not out of here tonight. Representative Dominguez, welcome to the committee. And I will move that House File 924 be recommended to pass and be moved to the General Register. Representative Dominguez, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Real quick, I know you're short on time. Thank you for listening to this bill. House File 924, let me just quickly read it over. It's a bill that relating to an employment regulating unpaid work for cash assistance, providing code for a new law in Minnesota Statute Chapter 181. I'm sure you all received the information, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to turn it over. They just want to speak a little bit about the bill.
Kate, okay, welcome to the committee. Why don't you just identify yourself?
My name is Lyndon Galboy. I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee. I'm going to read my testimony, and if it's choppy, forgive me. I tried to really shorten it up so it might not flow. But I just want to say that we are completely opposed to workfare. Workfare forces parents in poverty to work for no pay in order to receive the monthly welfare grant. House File 924 will prohibit workfare in Minnesota unless it's on an absolutely voluntary basis. The impact of workfare on the entire working population is devastating. If it were allowed to happen, workfare would serve to drive down wages and displace workers. Workfare is a direct attack on working people as a whole, on organized labor, and on organizing efforts. Why would a boss continue to pay someone to do a job or to bargain fairly with their employees if he or she can go down to the welfare office and get someone who is forced to do that job for no pay? To sum it up, if workfare were allowed to take root in Minnesota, it would be a disaster for all working people. The bottom line is, if there is a job to be done, it should be made into a real job with real wages. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I have another testifier real quickly.
Okay, why don't we take both testifiers and then we'll open up to questions on the bill, and Representative Dominguez and the testifiers. Welcome to the committee, ma'am.
Phyllis Walker, President of Ask Me Local 3800. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as word spreads about workfare, labor organizations are taking a stand. They are taking a stand against workfare. The labor organizations that have taken a formal position against workfare so far are Unite HERE, United Food and Commercial Workers, that's the UFCW Local 789, representing 7,500 workers in Minnesota, Ask Me Local 8, representing 800 public employees in Minnesota, Ask Me Local 3800, representing 1,600 clerical workers at the University of Minnesota, Ask Me Council 5, representing 40,000 public employees in Minnesota, St. Paul Trades and Labor, representing 40,000 workers from many different unions in St. Paul, and the Minnesota AFL-CIO, representing 300,000 workers in Minnesota. If workfare is allowed to continue, not only will working people suffer, but the economy of Minnesota will suffer as well. As an elected representative of the clerical workers of the University of Minnesota, I respectfully urge you to act in the best interest of the state of Minnesota and to put an end to workfare. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say also we have some other moms and sisters that are here today, that if they want to stand up and just approach the members there. They're a little shy. No, you don't need to come. Just want to stand.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Okay, are there any questions to Representative Dominguez or the witnesses? Okay, if not, then you have heard the testimony. I'll represent Wealthy.
Thank you, Chairman Rukavina, and to Representative Dominguez. Okay, if your bill is passed, and then what is the financial impact upon the state of Minnesota? And I mean, I'm just looking at the policy here, but I don't really know what the financial impact will be. Do we have a fiscal note on this? Did you request one? Do we have state agencies that are going to comment on this bill?
Representative Welty, I will leave that up to House Research to answer that question.
I don't believe there's a fiscal note on it.
There's not a fiscal note, but if they want to comment on it.
I know. Council, would you say that there's a financial impact? I don't think there is. Our fiscal analyst, ask him.
Actually,
go ahead.
Mr. Chair, it's not my area. My understanding with this bill is that it just regulates what people receiving assistance under MFIP may or may not be required to do, and that it doesn't change their eligibility status. The Human Services Finance Committee has not requested the bill, to my knowledge.
So, Representative Welty, I would say there's no financial impact. I don't know if there's it intermingles and it references some of the TANF law in statute. Ms. Novak, you might want to mention that, but I think you've heard the gist of the bill is that you can't force anybody to work for their cash payments. So. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, and to Representative Dominguez, I'm just wondering, did you work with any of the current Minnesota, current staff that work with these programs? When you designed the bill,
This bill was given to me by the unpaid workers' assistance, and I personally didn't work with them. But they probably can answer those questions for you.
Okay. Ms. Galboy, could you shed some light on this? You might want to mention about the companion bill.
Right, there's conforming language in the welfare that's gone through the welfare bill that has passed both the House and the Senate. and this is just to kind of bolster that language. There was no fiscal note in the welfare section, and we don't expect there to be one for this.
So this has had some substantial input from the Human Services Committee. This merely puts it in the Department of Labor and Industry, of which we have jurisdictions statutes. So we've heard the testimony. There's no more questions. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Dominguez and members. Next we have on the next we have Representative Nornes, House File. Representative Nornes. Well, we'll somebody can go get Representative Nornes. Oh, there you are. Representative Nornes. I didn't see you come in the room. Representative Nornes, House File 626. Representative Nornes, this is the Achieve 2, and so we have a fiscal note. To Representative Nornes moves House File 626 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus Health and Human Service Higher Education Bill. Welcome, Mr. Michikanis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we're going to be making good use of our time here and being brief as we can. I'll quickly just begin by saying that I was a big fan of the governor's original plan when it came to providing some incentives for our students in high school to perhaps get a benefit of a nearly free or completely free college education. The bill we're looking at today is plan number 2, referred to as the Achieve Scholarship Program. And this, instead of 4 years, this would probably enable a high school senior to plan on getting 1 free year of college. That's kind of the goal. I have with me here Mark, Mr. Connors. Maybe would you like to hit some of the highlights?
Mr. Chair and members of the record, I'm Mark Michikanis with the Office of Higher Education. You have heard part of this before when the governor's bill was in front of you. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, your bill was described for the committee.
And a good bill it was, right?
Let me just kind of briefly hit the highlights and give you a better sense of the underlying assumptions in the fiscal note. I have not seen the note tonight, but I think the cost is about $39 million annually. It was the analysis that we had worked on. I think the underlying aspect of this is what Representative Nornes said, is that the governor recognized a public policy problem. Actually, it was twofold: high tuition rates and some lack of incentives towards more rigorous programs to be taken by students in high school. This was the method that he arrived at to deal with that problem. The bill would offer a scholarship of $314 per course for courses taken in high school grades 9 to 12, as listed on the bottom of page 1 in subdivision 4 and continued on page 2. These are AP courses, IB courses, PSEO courses. You can see the list there. As we've had discussions with members throughout the session, we do recognize that there are certain parts of the states where these are less available to some students than in other parts of the state, and I think that's an important consideration. I should mention, Mr. Chair, that we struggle with the notion of rigorous courses. I think that would have been the preferred way to go as opposed to this list in front of you, but it becomes very difficult to kind of put a stake in the ground about what constitutes rigor and what doesn't, in a way that everybody can agree to. These are clearly identified courses, so I think that was the position that the governor had to resort to, because they are clearly identified and we know when a student takes them. The student has come from a family of less than $100,000 of adjusted gross income. They need to be a U.S. citizen, and the scholarship would stay with the Office of Higher Education until such time as the student graduated from high school and attended a Minnesota post-secondary institution. And we would make a direct payment to the school on behalf of the student for tuition purposes. There is one other aspect on page 2. There is a review panel to help us work through the courses, and to the extent that other options were available, I suspect we could come back to the legislature and ask for changes to that list to expand it. Mr. Chair, for the purposes of the fiscal note, since that there is the $100,000 of income limitation, we used some tax information that we had actually gotten from House Research to estimate the number of children or and families making that amount of money or less. It's roughly 25,000 students that would attend college. The number of students is actually higher than that, but only some of those would attend college. We assume for the purposes of this note that the students would take about 5 courses on average. I know that some students take more than that, some would take less. So, but for the purpose of the appropriation, we assume the number 5, which results in the $39 million figure.
Okay. Questions of Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you describe for me what work-based learning programs are? That's page 2.
Representative Nornis or Mr. Michikanis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppe, I'm afraid I cannot. This is a list that came from the Department of Education. So I will have to contact them and get that information to you after the meeting.
Representative Gatto, do you have can you inform?
Wouldn't that be customized job training that we do in many of schools like yours? Representative Poppe.
That would be my question, I guess.
I'm
not
that's
sure.
That's what it is.
I was thinking maybe it was a technical type training program or apprentice type program, but I don't know the answer to that either. Is there anybody from the Department of Education that could answer that? Okay. No? I'm just wondering about the Representative Nornis. There are a lot of schools in rural Minnesota that might not have the ability to offer these courses. I know up in my neck of the woods, they've kind of cut to the bone, and as you can tell sometimes by my grammar, they've cut English even in some of the schools. So, you know, I'm wondering what the how we are going to be able to do this in some school districts. I don't care if it's Indus and between Vedette and International Falls, or I can probably name a few little districts. Representative Gunther can help me out.
In southern Minnesota.
And have you thought about that, or the governor's staff thought about that, Mr. Michikanis or Representative Nornis? Who wants to take that one?
Mr. Chair, that's why I made the earlier comment that we are well aware that there is some issues with that. And I tried to express the point that we tried to deal with some alternatives to course rigor, which I think is the ultimate goal of this. We may not be there. I would admit to that. It's a problem that we need to work on.
What is it, and Mr. Michikanis, on page 2, help me wade through the on lines 212 and 2.12 and 2.13. So let me see if I'm following this. The course, I take some courses and I get this $400 and whatever it is dollars, whether or not the post-secondary institution grants a credit for them. Does that refer to like the baccalaureate course? Maybe a post-secondary institution wouldn't recognize it. I'm not following with that.
Sure. I think maybe the clearest way to think about this is a student can take an AP course, and I think they doesn't take the test in order to qualify for college credit. Many colleges will take a 3 on that test. It ranges from 1 to 5, I believe. Not all colleges will. More highly selective colleges may require a 4 or even a 5, or may not even take the course for credit itself. That statement on lines 12 and 13 would simply say the students still would get the $314 regardless if they got college credit for the course.
So I was reading it like maybe I take a post-secondary course, and I'm in 11th grade at the Mesabi Community College, and I don't finish it or I don't pass it, and do I still get credit for it? Could that be misinterpreted to mean that? So I could flunk even and I could get credit for it? Or get an incomplete?
Well, Mr. Chair, the language does require that the high school send a transcript documenting the qualifying courses a student took.
But it doesn't say it had to pass it.
If it wasn't completed, I suppose it wouldn't even appear in the transcript. But if it was failed, we should probably have some clarifying language to take care of that. I think the intent is that a student actually passed the course at the high school level, regardless of if it qualifies at the post-secondary level.
Representative Poppy, were you done?
No, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up, actually, on what you were just saying. I think even on 2.26, where it says take qualifying courses or earn credits, that, again, isn't clear enough to indicate that they have passed a course. That's only if you take a course. So maybe that is certainly something that should be clarified.
Okay. Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe when I grow up, I want to be a legislative drafter, but it just seems like if we add the words and pass after the word take, that would, on line 2.26, take and pass qualifying courses. I mean,
that would probably work. Representative Norris, would you
I think
move
that's
that?
That's a good a suggestion.
Representative Norris moves oral amendment on pit line 2.26 after take and pass. All those, any questions on whether or not they should pass? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign, motion prevails. We'll still have to clarify that other language up above.
Assumption, Mr. Chair, is that we're talking about, you know, rigorous courses, and we're assuming that none of these students would ever fail.
Okay. Well, maybe they just didn't pay attention, but we'll have to work on this. Are there any other questions on this? I'm still very concerned about some poor school districts, in whether they're in urban or suburban or rural Minnesota, that don't have the capabilities of offering this and maybe don't have post-secondary options in that. But, you know, if you take a post-secondary option course, that was the purpose of post-secondary option that Governor Purpich proposed, that you're getting, you know, college credits. And I know several of my, I didn't let my kids take any courses because, you know, I was a legislator and I didn't want teachers and school districts and superintendents to be mad at me, so I didn't let them do it. So I said I went to the poorhouse. But anyway, but the purpose is to, that was the purpose of the program, and so you're going to get credit for it. You're going to get credit for it, and then you're going to get money for taking it. Besides, and your school district is losing money by letting a student take
it. Mr. Chair, I don't want to cut you short, but I think the one thing I wanted to point out, the original plan that the governor had would have applied to all students, you know, in every school district. This is not the Cadillac plan that he originally started with. So it does have some compromises and some things that aren't as attractive, but because the price tag was extremely high on that first plan. But the goal of this and that was to encourage the students to kind of push a little bit, take the rigorous courses, and particularly aim at science and math, where we're, as a country, lacking. And I think that was what the intention was originally. This bill also is going in that direction. But it's really a downsized program and, again, does not fit every school district in the state, unfortunately.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And probably it's to that point and your point, Mr. Chair, this to me is just creating a greater inequity for our students in rural Minnesota. And certainly I have some school districts in my area that are trying to figure out how to have advanced calculus and geometry and science and math and pre-engineering kinds of courses. So they're looking for how they can actually serve those students. And I'm concerned that, again, it just creates a greater inequity because certain school districts will have more opportunity. Those students will have greater opportunity to be able to take post-secondary courses and to be able to achieve, where I have students in some of my area that will not be able to achieve based on this. Thank you.
Representative Detmer.
And Mr. Chairman, I guess I see this as rewarding students with lower income ability to take more rigorous courses, and maybe would encourage districts to also provide these courses for their schools. So I think we need to somehow encourage students to take more rigorous courses, and this is just one way of I think the governor seeing that we can do this.
Well, Representative Detmer, that's the problem. Like I said, we don't. You came from a growing school district, and if you're coming from a school district where the enrollment keeps going down and down and down, I was looking at some figures for some taconite production tax ideas for school funding the other day, and most of the 14 schools in the taconite relief area. I was looking at the law from 1988. From 1988 to 2000 and today, 2007, or these were 2006 school year numbers, every one of those schools except Crosby Arrington has lost half of their enrollment. And so as they've lost their enrollment, and being that funding is based on enrollment, and then we've not kept up with funding, they've cut to the bone. They can hardly offer the electives they're required, their kids are required to graduate with. So they don't offer these programs. That's the problem. Unless we're going to count some, you know, these Arizona or Phoenix, I mean, schools are low online. I don't know how it's going to work. That's my only question with it, but we'll try to see if we can make it work. Representative Stevenson, did you have a question?
No, sir.
Okay. Representative Detmer, go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, point well taken, you know, but We still need.
No, I never got English in school. I mean, ja govorim dobro hrvatski, ali.
Mr. Chairman, I spent 6 years in a country school, one room, one teacher, six grades. So.
And that, those were the days that if you got out of line, they could yank you by the ear. And
you better believe it.
Yeah. Got out of line, they could yank you by the ear. And
you better believe it.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just probably one follow-up. It's not that we don't have students who want to be able to do this. They truly just, our school districts just don't have the money to be able to provide it. That's what I'm saying. It's the greater inequity is they don't have the possibility to be able to do some of this. So I would like to just want to make that point. And I appreciate that you've commented on.
And maybe, members, as we think about what we're going to do on the bill next week and for possible inclusion, we can think of some ways to accomplish that. And by the way, Representative Demmer, I noticed that one ear of yours is longer than the other. So did you get yanked around a little bit in that country school? Or
mm-hmm. A little cauliflower ear, too.
One.
That's a wrestling coach, yeah. Right? Yeah. Okay, any other comments? Thank you both.
Mr. Chair, I would just conclude by saying that I know that probably this isn't perfect, but to do nothing, I think, would also be probably the wrong choice. So we'll be visiting about this.
Well, yes, we will, and we'll be discussing this next week and as we put the bill together. And if anybody has any ideas on maybe utilizing post-secondary options more and things like that, too, we can help from that. Now I'm going to take Representative Norton next because Representative Gunther's testifiers all work here, and she's got someone from St. Cloud, I believe. Representative Norton, would you like to move your bill for possible inclusion?
I would like to move House File 877 for possible inclusion.
In the omnibus bill. Representative Norton, go ahead, and then your testifiers are here.
Thank you, Chair Rukavina and members. Currently in the state of Minnesota, we have a shortage of speech pathologists, speech and language pathologists, to work with our students in our schools. A recent Minnesota Department of Education survey of special ed directors indicated that filling speech pathology positions is the greatest staffing challenge that they have, more so than any other special education specialty area. school districts throughout the state have unfilled speech and language pathologist positions or have less qualified persons fulfilling the tasks that a speech and language pathologist would be doing. Because of this current and growing shortage, many of our children's communication needs are not being met. In order to address this growing shortage, the Minnesota Speech and Hearing Association has requested that the state create a loan forgiveness program, and that's what's in the bill, in order to help encourage, recruit and encourage people to go into the field of speech pathology. And as you may or may not know, in the state of Minnesota, a master's degree is required, so it is extra training to even get into the field. And also that perhaps there are some people, graduates of the last few years that are home, maybe encourage them to go into the field. At this time, I'd like to introduce Meredith Boo, the legislative chair for MSHA, who will discuss the situation, and then we'd be happy to have them, or I would be happy to address any of the questions that you might have.
Welcome to the committee, ladies. Just identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I'm Meredith Boo. I'm a speech-language pathologist in Bloomington Schools. Been working for 28 years. We do have a significant shortage of speech-language pathologists. We're also known as speech therapists. Students who qualify to get services in speech-language pathology have to score at the bottom 2% of the population in Minnesota in order to get services. They have difficulties with articulation, language, stuttering, and voice quality. That's why there's a master's degree requirement to work with these students. We need to know development and how to fix these disorders to help these students. The special ed directors had talked about in a survey how difficult it is to fill the positions. There was also a survey done by the Minnesota Department of Education of speech-language pathologists in Minnesota schools. They indicated that 36% of their districts had unfilled speech-language pathology positions. And it's predicted within the next 3 to 5 years, 44% of Minnesota speech-language pathologists in the schools will leave the profession for retirement or for other reasons. So we have a significant difficulty facing us. Some districts with unfilled positions are having general education teachers or special education teachers without specific training in speech-language pathology provide services, or they are not filling the position, and speech-language pathologists have caseloads of 50, 60, sometimes 70 students. In these cases, students with the significant needs that they have in communication are not getting the appropriate services that they need.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Monica Devers, and I'm the chair of the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders up at St. Cloud State University. And I'm here representing my colleagues in the 5 training programs here in the state that educate and train students to become speech pathologists. When we do our surveys of potential graduate students and also our faculty as well, we know that one of the major roadblocks to getting a master's degree in speech pathology is the high cost of a graduate education. Loan forgiveness for speech pathologists working in the schools, we believe, would help us attract and retain qualified speech pathologists in Minnesota. At least 8 states already have loan forgiveness programs, and 2 of our neighbors in Wisconsin and North Dakota have loan or tuition forgiveness programs currently in existence. Other states have bonuses to attract speech pathologists to come and work in our schools. When we survey my colleagues in the 5 programs, we estimate that we graduate about 60 to 65 students per year to work in the Minnesota schools. And we propose that this bill would forgive 1/4 of the remaining loan principal for each year that a speech pathologist commits to working in Minnesota schools. We believe this bill will help us attract and retain qualified speech pathologists in Minnesota so that our students with communication challenges and impairments will get the services they need. Thank you for your time.
Questions of the Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, lawyers, speech pathologists, this is going to be a tough choice.
Representative Hartman, do you have any?
Mr. Chair, I wanted to say some supportive words about the speech pathologist. As a child, I had a pretty bad speech impediment, and I needed services for 3 years in elementary school. And so it is a life-changing thing that they do, and I think it is worthy work. It's as worthy as the important work done by legal aid attorneys.
Ms. Boer, Ms. Davis,
Do I sound like Dan Rathers to you, or do you think I have an accent? Because I don't think I have an accent. Do I have an accent?
Chair Rukavina, we do have some help here, so if you'd like some therapy afterward.
It's not. We should mix a Scottish accent with your accent and see what we end up with.
Is that what you have, a Scottish?
That's what I have.
I didn't know if it was Celtic or Scandinavian.
You look like Dan Rather.
And what was the amount of money you were thinking of plugging into this?
I'll double whatever it says on the paper.
Okay, no, Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just a point of information. You had talked on your sheet here, and you mentioned bonuses.
Hey, Representative Briner, if I could just, I see Representative Pawlowski is here. And,
no, I was never here.
Excuse me, go ahead.
Bonuses for equivalency to the national boards, and there are school districts in the state that do offer that. Mankato Area Public Schools does. We credit national boards, and we credit speech pathologist professional credential for a stipend in the contract. I'm just saying that we do recognize the importance of your professional credential.
Yeah, now, Ms. Boo, you work out of the Bloomington School District, you said. How many school districts in the state of Minnesota, given the last discussion that we had about baccalaureate programs, how many school districts are able to have a speech pathologist?
Excuse me. Well, I believe every school district has at least one speech-language pathologist. I don't know. What happens is if special education directors answer questions about filling their positions, they may have filled them with unqualified people. And so it's hard to get that information at a state level. So
I don't know if any of my districts actually have. Maybe they contract with a clinical speech pathologist or something for that.
Not to that point. Here's my question.
To this point, Representative
Harlan? Yes. Mr. Chair, I would think that some cooperatives are around in the state that would provide these services.
Go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I was just thinking, too, about the shortage of nurses and how businesses and hospitals and different entities have gotten together to put up some dollars for it, and I just thought that might be another suggestion to help the speech pathology, because I know that's actually going for pretty well.
And Representative, Were you thinking of a number? Were you thinking of how many people you wanted to serve?
There is a fiscal note, Chair Rukavina, and it.
Well,
do you have it? And I think they didn't estimate of how many graduates.
I don't think. Do you have a fiscal note? Because you have a blank number. So. Yeah.
I have one. I was given a fiscal note. I'm sorry if you were not given one. Would you like it?
We don't have a fiscal note. But let me. No. How did you get a fiscal note when you don't have a number?
I requested one and they sent me one.
It must be zero, like the appropriation.
No, there's a rationale, I believe. Is it with that? Page 2, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was wondering where the rest of it was. Okay.
Chair Rukavina, while that's coming to you, I can tell you we were a little surprised with how low the number was, and part of that is based on the number of anticipated graduations coming up, and you'll see the assumptions that they put in there, but it is a rather low amount.
Yeah, yes. Members, for your information, it's about 50 grand.
That's a quarter of what the lawyers are asking.
I know. And Representative Searson, we need a lot more speech pathologists than we need more lawyers.
You need already.
Okay. Thank you very much, then, all of you, if there are no further questions. Oh, Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I just ask a question? I realize that you need a master's degree, but what would prepare somebody, what at the baccalaureate level, prepares someone to then move into master's level? What kind of degree or emphasis?
All of the programs will anticipate accepting some students who complete an undergraduate degree in communication sciences or disorders, but we certainly have certain tracks at the graduate level where we would take students from other fields as well, social work, any of the allied health professionals. We have lots of students who come in with a different undergraduate major and then transition into speech pathology at the graduate level.
Thank you. And I might just interject. I actually was a speech pathology and audiology major in college. I haven't had a chance to tell these ladies this, but... And one of the reasons I switched to special education was because of the master's and PhD path that you really were going on, and at that point I was ready to take a break from school. So in the state of Minnesota, with the increased requirements, it makes it difficult. There really isn't an end path for a person with a bachelor's degree in speech pathology in the professional world. And so I didn't know if that's what you were getting at.
No, I understand that. I work as a career counselor usually, so it's just more of a personal question, I guess, so that I could help to perhaps educate students if they're ready to move on to something and are looking for a career. So thank you.
So what is, you have a BA in or B?
I have a Bachelor of Science degree in Special Education Human Development with a minor in Speech Path because I didn't ever finish.
Okay, and do you still have student debt?
I paid mine off. My husband has money if you'd like, though.
Okay. No further questions, and thank you. Oh, Representative Eastland, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, what would be the, if a speech pathologist typically would have a master's, is that where we're going? What would be the typical salary range that somebody that would be hired as a speech pathologist in that field?
Ms. Davis or who?
We'd estimate about $30,000 starting salary because they have a master's degree. Yeah.
That's less than the lawyers and legal aid.
Speech-language pathologists have a board of teaching license to work in the schools, and they start in a, they're part of the teacher's salary.
Okay, so they would be paid.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Gunther moves that House File 851 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Higher Education Workforce Development Bill. Representative Gunther, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I'm sorry we're going to prolong this a little bit, just a little thick book, Bill. Now, you've all heard, most of this bill does not apply to this committee. And the code part that does was taken out of this bill. So I have very little left, and you've heard it all already. I'll go through the highlights of what we're funding here, and I'll certainly be open to any questions you have. But we fund the Department of Employment Economic Development, Labor and Industry, Board of Mediation Services, and a bunch of smaller boards such as the Arts, Accountancy, Architecture, Barber and Cosmetology, Boxing, Workers' Comp, Court of Appeals. And that's basically what's in this bill that's pertinent to this committee. Now with that, Mr. Chairman and members, I'll open it up to questions. I have a whole panel of experts right here.
Representative Gunther, yes, members, we have heard, you know, testimony previously. I think most of you know the governor's funding recommendations, and we'll be, and we've heard a lot of bills that have asked for money from DEED and from, you know, whether it's ongoing or one time. So I do have a question, though. Your boxing bill disappeared, your bill for the boxing board.
I put it in, and I was waiting for a hearing.
Evidently, it went to Commerce, like
is that
some
the
of our bills
bill?
Did, and it's there. But, you know, I think you and I both made some promises to Mr. Ledoux. So being that they couldn't hear it, we'll probably have to see that maybe as an amendment offered up next week sometime, Representative Gunther.
I think that's a great idea.
It's not our fault that we didn't get the bill.
That's right.
And we've had several bills, I think, that have been hung up there, members, that at least they've had a hearing there in Representative Dabney's committee, but never made it to Representative Atkins' committee. And it's my intention that those bills did have a public hearing, even if it wasn't under this committee. So some of those may be appearing here as amendments when we put this bill together, and I would encourage you to do something with that if you so wish.
I will check with the Commerce Commission.
Are there any Representative Haas?
Yes, Representative, I have a language question on page 203. No, I was just...
I'm sorry.
Right.
Representative Haas, that's not in the purview of this committee.
We... We have staff, and we'll be going through the whole bill, and as we do this, members, next, let me just say this. Are there any questions, further questions, to Representative Gunther's bill or of the staff from Deed or Dolly that's here? We are probably going to be seeing, you know, we're going to be going through the, putting the bill together next week. My intention is to let all of you see the bill sometime Monday during the day, even though we have a Monday night hearing with bills that we couldn't get here through no fault of our own because of this process. So we have a couple of construction code bills, I think, that we're going to hear on Monday night. We're going to do this one, but we wanted to hear it tonight. I think Representative Briner just had a bill referred to our committee. We didn't even know what it is yet. What is it, Representative Briner? Do you know? Okay. So we're going to, you know, I intend for you to have the bill a full day ahead of time. We'll get it to you sometime Monday, and then we've got the hearing Monday night on a couple of code bills, big bills, very, very big bills that we'll have to, if we're going to do anything with them, put them in as amendments. If you can get that language tomorrow on the boxing board, that your bill that never got saw the light of day, maybe we can just incorporate it in the bill, because I don't think, unless anybody has a problem with that, or if they do, they can argue about it on Tuesday when we start hearing the bill. And we'll be hearing the bill on Tuesday and Wednesday and Tuesday night and Wednesday and Wednesday night. So it has to be out by midnight Wednesday. So we could have many, many hours of hearings. Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will have the language that you asked for in a compromise language for you tomorrow.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the language from these bills going to be in the omnibus bill?
Yes, there will be considerable. We will have an omnibus bill that's probably, if I stand on it, I could be 6 feet tall. Who knows? So, I mean, we're going to have a lot of policy in our bill,
Mr. Chair.
Because we are a policy and a finance committee. So, like any finance bill, it's going to have a, you know, bunch of appropriations at the front, and then it'll have, you know, just like this bill here, and then it's going to have a lot of policy behind it, and we'll be amending it and offering amendments, and I'm sure there's going to be amendments offered to put things in and amendments offered to pull things out.
Mr. Chairman, we have a real person who'd like to testify about this bill, please.
Sir, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Eric Nathanson. I'm the financial resources coordinator for the Minneapolis Consortium of Community Developers. My organization is part of a group of nonprofit business development agencies that participate in BEAD's Urban Initiative Loan Program, UIP. We are here tonight to support the governor's request for $1 million in business loan capital for UIP in the next biennium. And that request is incorporated in House File 851 that Representative Gunther has introduced. Several members of our group are here tonight. I'd like to introduce them. Maybe they can just stand briefly. Richard Vinegar with the Milestone Growth Fund.
Welcome.
George Jacobson with Metropolitan Economic Development Association. And Jonathan Sage Martinson with SPARC. We all serve as intermediaries for DEED, which means that our organizations are able to draw on UIP funds to provide loans for our small business clients. Many of us focus primarily on capital access for minority, new arrival, and women-owned businesses. During the past few years, more than 80% of the loans provided by my organization have gone to minority and women-owned firms that face challenges in obtaining the capital they need from commercial banking system. UIP provides much-needed loan capital for our borrowers, but capital is only part of the equation. They also need technical assistance and business counseling that we generate our own funds to provide those services. And our goal is to move our loan clients into the economic mainstream and recycle their loan payments to help the next group of emerging entrepreneurs. We use these UIP funds to leverage private dollars, usually on a one-to-one basis, so that means that the $1 million in this bill will leverage an additional $1 million in loan capital for emerging businesses in Minnesota. This budget item is a one-time only request. However, because UIP operates on a revolving loan basis, the loan repayments from our borrowers will be returned to deed and through us loaned out again, so the impact of this appropriation will extend beyond the next biennium. UIP fills an important unmet need. It's cost-effective, has a proven track record, and I hope that when your committee gets to the markup that you can approve this $1 million request. Thank you very much, and can certainly answer any questions that the committee might have.
Does anybody have any questions of Mr. Nathanson, is it?
Yes.
It's in the governor's initiative, I think, at a million. Was it a million?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Representative Gunter.
I just have one question. If you lend this money out, I assume you get slight interest. How much do you have in your portfolio of funds today?
Mr. Nathanson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, we have a variety of funds. We draw on UIP as the loans become available. So at any one point, it's a matter of what deed has in their funding source, and that number changes from day to day because as loan payments come in, they're loaned out. Our particular organization has access to probably about an additional $200,000 in loan funds, but those loan funds are being drawn down, and if we don't get new funds, we won't be able to continue the program next year.
Okay. Any further questions of Representative Gunther, the witness, or staff on anything in the Representative Welty?
Thank you, Chairman Rukavina. And to Representative Gunther, I know you've thoroughly reviewed this bill, and I'm wondering if you can tell me that looking at the electrical board section of this bill, and I'm on page 110, 111, and I'm just wondering if you can answer this, Representative Gunther, or if there are staff here tonight that can answer my questions as to this section of the bill. Is this dealing with all of the electrical fee inspection increases that we talked about that were related to the $4 million appropriation that was taken from the board a few years back?
Representative Welty, maybe I can, Mr. Representative Gunther, I mentioned that we're going to be hearing a couple of bills on Monday, and I think Representative Mahoney's bill has kind of morphed into that whole issue along with a number of other fee issues and the other plumbers and other building trades. So we'll be having a full hearing on that Monday night, although the bill probably won't contain that because we don't have it here yet. So, and maybe it will. I'm not sure how I'm going to do that. But Representative Gunther.
Since I was there when they took the $4 million, you very aptly put, the $4 million was in a fund that would pay for inspectors. A lot of it was committed. A lot of inspections were not made. A lot of money was kept from fees for various things the Board of Electricity did. So a good share of that $4 million was not money that was due to an inspector at all. It was money that had accrued. So the amount that was still left that belonged to inspectors is being covered by new building permits coming out and new fees being paid. When we took that $4 million, things were a little tight in the state of Minnesota. And even though it was not my idea, and I didn't necessarily appreciate it very much, when you looked at the whole total picture, it wasn't that we took $4 million from electrical inspectors. It we took $4 million from surpluses in the funds that accrued over the years.
And from a number of other funds also, I might add.
When we took it, we swept the floor.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a fun time.
So, I think we've got a couple of code bills that we'll be discussing, and you know, Representative Welty, the proposal, you know, by the governor backs those out of the general fund and puts them into special funds, and I think Representative Mahoney's bill does the same or similar, and it also it's charged against us here on the committee, so I'd just soon leave it the way it is, but anyhow, go ahead.
Yeah, well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm just looking at it, and I'm seeing just about every single fee that's in here has been increased to make up for that, and I know I looked into it a couple of years ago, and I actually introduced a bill that'll be coming up on the calendar here that would essentially appropriate that $4 million back to the fund from general fund resources now. But I think it's, you know, we're starting to see the results of some of the things that were done in the past, and when we were told that we weren't going to have fee increases, now we're starting to see them, and we're seeing those effects. And so I just wanted to make that point, make that note. And it, as I understand it, it's part of this, and I'm hoping that we can address it in the future. And Representative Gunther, I know you went through tough times and you had tough decisions to make, and I respect that.
Well, Representative Welke, depending on whose figures you use, there were fees increased anywhere from $700 to $1 billion. So, you know, which was about the exact cost of the income tax cuts that were made in 99 and 2000, but that's a whole other issue. Representative Gunther, do you want to?
Representative Welke, when they merged all the various codes together, I don't know how those funds were commingled. So that's the question that remains to be answered. I think you might be right on with that.
Okay. Mr. Nathanson, you don't have to sit there through this whole discussion. Thank you very much. And I think we're just about done anyhow. Are there any other questions of the author or anything else about committee members? Anybody from the audience want to say anything?
Did you do your bill?
No, absolutely.
No, I'm not doing my bill. My bill is going to be, I think Senator Bach thinks that bill should be in his tax bill. For what reason, I don't know. But so I'm humoring him. Meeting adjourned, members.